Smith Show starts now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be taking a look back at the week that was. The J-1 students who are being exploited at the, well, I shouldn't put it that way. Yes, I should. Exploited. Exactly the exact same scenario that we saw a year and a half ago at Hershey being replicated again. And you got to wonder, how pervasive is this? How much of this is going on right under our nose? And I point back to the neighborhood where you had 8 or 9 kids living in the basement of a house. In any neighborhood USA. I mean, to drive down the street, you would never know it. That kind of behavior is going on right there. And the fact that nobody ever reported it to me is concerning on a number of levels. If you're living next door and you see this, shouldn't you say something? I mean, isn't that being part of the community? But we're going to look at that. Also, the education numbers and the education closures across the country. We talked last night about what's going on in Philadelphia and Chicago. It's coming across the country. And this idea that we need to privatize and profitize everything that we the people do must be stopped. Very simple stuff. You can contact me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. I look forward to that as well. Big news today. Big news. The economy created 236,000 new jobs. They were expecting, I think it was 160,000. Ended up with 236. I guess it's a push in the right direction. My problem, we only created about 14,000 manufacturing jobs. And again, austerity on the public sector side, a loss of another 10,000 jobs. And I keep going back to the assault on public sector work, to the work that folks do for our children, for our seniors, for our community, this all-out frontal assault. What it's done to our economy, you're talking, we're probably somewhere around 800,000 to a million jobs that have been eviscerated, or just gone, wiped out. Had we those million jobs, we wouldn't be talking about a 7.7% unemployment rate. We'd be talking probably about a 6.7% unemployment rate and an economy that would be heating up. And while, look, I'm happy to see that we got better than expected job numbers. I'm happy to see that things are going. Some of the numbers are looking in the right directions. For instance, the U6 numbers fell to 14.3%. That's basically all the people who are looking, not just the people who are collecting unemployment. So that number has fallen. It looks like things are going slowly in the right direction. Here's my problem. A dirty bomb went boom. These cuts are coming. The 700,000 jobs that are predicted to be lost are going to wipe out these gains again. So all of the gains that we've had, Republicans and the austerity hawks have wiped a good portion of that out. And you go, what is it, 2 steps forward, 2 steps back? Is this the way we want to go? And I don't think so. And I saw some interesting numbers out today about the wealth of the nation. And I look at these jobs, you know, the way that the working class of this country builds wealth is through selling their labor, which I find, you know, going back to yesterday's discussion about Rand Paul's wanting to revive Lochner, and what a wonderful decision the Lochner decision was, you know, making sure that, well, that people don't have the, that government doesn't have the ability to put maximum hour laws or minimum wage or health and safety or any of those laws on the books. Because, hey, if you're desperate enough to work in a toxic environment for pennies on the dollar, then you should be allowed, right? Well, the wealth that workers, people like you and me, people who work for a living, the wealth that we create is through selling our time, selling the hours of our lives. And, you know, we buy our house and, you know, maybe the house, you know, increases in value a little bit. The recession, the Bush recession, wiped most of that out. Interesting Fed numbers out, though. The $16 trillion that was lost because of the Bush recession, evidently now back. In 2012, the Federal Reserve said the household wealth of the nation was about $66.1 trillion. Now, if you look at, since the stock market's gone through the roof and all of these estimates, it looks like now, this year, we are above the pre-recession number, and everything's going to look great. Except, and I use the Tea Party word because I think it fits here, We've seen a massive redistribution of wealth. Now understand, after the Bush collapse, what happened was, pretty simply, we lost $16 trillion, down to $51.4 trillion in net worth. Who got hit by that? Well, you and I did. Because understand how this is all calculated, this net worth thing. It's the value of your home, value of your assets, value of stocks, you know, bank accounts, whatever you've got, whatever your assets are, minus your debts, minus your credit cards. Well, 30% is what they're saying the home value is down now. Still 30%. So you lost 30% of the whatever equity you had in your house. A lot of people lost jobs, ran up their credit cards. So the net worth of the working class, I would argue, considerably less. And if you look at how this whole thing's been borne out, because understand, people like you and me, working class folks, two-thirds of the middle class assets are your home. It's what you've got in the home. That's your asset. And we were told that's how you're going to build real wealth, buy a house. Well, like I said, national home values, 30% below the peak. So immediately 30% of that wealth gone. So now to say, now think about this, now to say that we're back to net worth pre-recession levels, in fact, above that, as a nation, when the middle class and the working folks of this country have most of their assets tied up into their home, which is 30% devalued, where do you think the recovery went? Because I've been saying for the longest time, a recovery happened. The vast majority of us just weren't part of it. We didn't get those massive gains. And, you know, there's study after study, and we talk about them on the program all the time. But you see it. You're living it. We know it. But this is just another one of those examples where the wealth of the middle class has been wiped out. And as we replace it, we're replacing it upward, right? The other part of this. You look at, you know, stocks and bonds and all of that stuff, your 401ks and all of those assets. Over the past 5 years, I know tons of people who said, you know, just to keep the lights on, I had to take some money out of my 401k, just to put food on the table. I had to cash in some stocks and some bonds. I had to cash in the investments at the worst possible time, which is when they were low. So now that the stock market has through the roof, guess who missed out on that rebound? Us, the working class. And I've always said that, you know, these booms and these busts are created to do just that. And this one did it masterfully. Because, you know, I think about this occasionally. You go, we have these big booms and the big busts. Who gets wealthy off of them? Well, the people who were already wealthy. They were the ones who were able to weather the storm. They were the ones who were able to buy your home when it was at rock bottom and then hold on to it long enough to sell it back to you. they were the ones who were buying the bonds at the bottom of the the scale and holding on to them through the entire thing. And we end up getting the short end of the stick. And what's infuriating to me on so many levels is you keep hearing people say, well, you know, giving food stamps or unemployment or getting things to people to just hold on through these periods. Somehow that's socialism. That's wrong. Yeah, we don't seem to have a problem handing hordes of money to big corporations. And I was looking at some data that was compiled by Bloomberg News. And they pointed out that right now there's about another $183 billion in money stored in these offshore accounts. In fact, three of them, Microsoft, Apple, and Google, have $135 billion of cash that they've stashed overseas. And in the last 2 years alone, an additional $60 billion. And you go, wow, that's outrageous. And all of this money that's parked overseas in these offshore tax havens, according to the data, $1.46 trillion for 83 companies? I mean, think about that. Just 83 multinational companies, almost $1.5 billion in money that they, or $1.5 trillion. What am I talking about? Billion. $1.5 trillion. And you might remember the report last year that J.P. Morgan Chase came out with that said, you know, all of the money that's parked overseas in these offshore tax havens amounted to about $1.7 trillion. Well, that's up now because these 83 companies, well, they held, according to Bloomberg, held about 75% of last year's total. So think about adding another quarter onto $1.7 trillion. Where does that put you? You're what, $1.9, $2 trillion, more than that? And you look at the companies, big, iconic companies, oh, the job creators, right? Not so much. General Electric has $108 billion that they're holding overseas. Pfizer, the big drug company, $73 billion. I mean, it's just obscene what we've allowed these big multinationals to get away with. And all of these schemes that they've bargained for, all of these schemes that they've put their lobbyists on, and yet, what are we told? We're told we need more austerity. We're told that, well, we need to cut. Something seriously wrong with this. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A bill currently winding its way through the Minnesota legislature could double the amount of money struggling families receive from welfare grants, Jesse Russell reports.
Currently, a family of two on the Minnesota Family Investment Program can expect to receive assistance at the same level as in 1987. $437 per month. According to the Welfare Rights Committee, 70% of the individuals on the program are children. Angela Bushner is an MFIP recipient and member of the Welfare Rights Committee.
You got to look at your son and you say, maybe ask for a scholarship or something because I don't have the money to do it.
The bill passed the Senate Health, Human Services, and Housing Policy Committee on Monday. Some lawmakers had attempted to live off of $51 per week, and on Tuesday, each reported they'd found the task to be impossible. Representative Susan Allen didn't need to take the challenge, because as a single mother, she lived off of the assistance while trying to put herself through school.
That gave me an opportunity take care of my sons.
A dozen workers at a nonprofit collective in Minnesota are on strike, seeking resolution of workplace grievances by insisting on their right to collectively bargain as a unit of the industrial workers of the world. John Snortum is one of the IWW workers at Sisters Camelot, which provides free food to low-income people who need it. Snortum says Sisters Camelot isn't respecting its workers, and despite being a collective, It's resisting true collective bargaining for its canvassers. The canvassers do door-to-door fundraising for Sisters Camelot.
The real issue that comes down to me is that they don't respect us as a part of Sisters Camelot. The way I see it is that they think Sisters Camelot is the collective, when really, you know, we raise 95% of the funds for Sisters Camelot, and they cannot do it without us.
The IWW Sisters Camelot workers have a list of demands and are attempting to negotiate them. The collective said in a statement that the workers are trying to force the collective into the role of boss. Then the collective acted very boss-like by firing Shug Mississippi, one of the IWW workers. Snortum says it's strange that a collectively run organization is resisting collective bargaining for workers.
Yeah, it is really strange, you know. The behavior that they're showing is a clear sign that they are drawing straws and that they're unwilling to give up any power that they hold.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. To keep worker and union voices on the air, go to laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Well, the austerity bomb went boom, and you look at the job numbers today, 236,000 jobs created. Well, 246,000 private sector, a negative 10,000 public sector jobs, more of that austerity. And get ready for more of this as these furloughs go into effect, as these cuts go into effect. All of the steps forward, all the movement we keep making forward, this austerity going to keep pushing us backward. Something seriously wrong with this. But anyway, in the area, again, you know, this exploitation of these students coming here from other countries to get a cultural experience, just mind-blowing, especially here in central Pennsylvania. And as we've been talking about the last couple of days, again, this exploitation of these J-1 visa workers, students, actually. I want to talk a little bit more, which is why I've asked Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, to come talk to us about the goings-on. Rick, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure, Rick. It's always great to be on the show.
So, again, here we are. I mean, a year and a half ago, you got arrested standing up for the kids that were being exploited by the Hershey Company, and now here we see a McDonald's in the local area doing almost the exact same thing, and maybe even worse in my view.
Well, you know, some people, I guess, see newspaper articles or see something on TV and are appalled by the exploitation of workers. And it would seem that now somebody read the newspaper articles and say, hey, I could do that myself. I could get free workers and, not free, but I could pay a minimum wage and I could get people to live in the rental units that I have as well. Recycle his own money. He pays it out from what he makes at McDonald's. He then deducts from their paychecks for the rent to pay his mortgage, and he just keeps generating income for himself and abusing these kids. And also the kind of noble goals of the J-1 visa program. But it's such a shame that there are folks who would find ways to exploit a noble idea, but I guess that's not new in history. People have been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, but you know, I look at this, and what you've laid out is the perfect example of the wealth class's definition of a hard day's work, shuffling it from one pocket to another.
Right. Putting it into our pocket for a little while, and then taking it right back out and putting it right back into theirs.
Yeah. The thing that gets me, though, Rick, is, you know, there's in my research of this is there's no way for me as a citizen, there's no way for anyone to find out where all these kids are being placed. And I understand that every year there are 100,000 of these kids that come into this country to have this kind of cultural exchange, to take jobs where they're supposed to be getting some experience on what it's like to be in a, you know, what the culture's like. Why can't we know where these kids are? Why do we not have the kind of oversight that I believe there should be, especially given the last two examples right here in our backyard?
Well, and, you know, I'm thinking that, I'm hoping that maybe these kids also knew something that was going on and knew that there was somebody they could reach out to. Because I'm sure Central Pennsylvania is not unique, but I'm guessing that a lot of these kids who come to it, first of all, I'm hoping that most of them are getting the real benefits of the program. But as we know, there's always a few bad apples that are going to spoil the whole thing. But we should know so that somebody could police this program, because there may be kids here who are being exploited but don't know where to turn. And, you know, Secretary Clinton, when we kind of exposed what was happening, actually made some real moves in terms of tightening up regulation and some oversight. But the problem is that, you know, again, it's one of those things where it's like the Department of Labor where, you know, the business community, yeah, okay, we pass a great law called OSHA, but, oh, by the way, we're not going to provide enough funding
right
to inspect the places for safety. So you have the same kind of thing. We have this kind of noble program to get these young students to learn a little bit about America, but no way to enforce the goals of that program to make sure that they are not being exploited.
Right. I was told by one of the people from the NGA that there are 8 inspectors nationwide for this program. 8.
Right, out of 100,000 them. And again, it's the laws are only as good as, you know, people's intention to be law-abiding citizens or some kind of enforcement mechanism.
You know, infuriating to me, though, is I walked by the house where these 8 or 9 kids were warehoused in the basement for $300 a month each, and it looks like my neighborhood. It looks like your neighborhood. You would never know that this kind of thing was going on right under our nose. And, you know, I got to wonder, the people in the neighborhood, were there, because the township manager said, no, nobody ever complained to us. You would think that someone would say, hey, there's something going on, something out that just doesn't look right.
Right, when you see a bunch of kids walking out of a house to walk to work and along the street, no car, no nothing, you gotta suspect that, you know, but, hey, unfortunately, you know, you live out in the suburbs, sometimes it's, you don't pay attention. You get in your car, go to work in the morning, you get home, you go into your house.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it is a shame that, you know, somebody could take a normal place like that and turn it into a site of, you know, exploitation. And again, it's wrong to house them all in the same place, but, you know, at least have, the men and women separated, having them in the same room really does is a throwback to boy, the old company towns. And
that's what I said,
you know,
company,
the early days,
I said the company town didn't leave us, it just moved to the suburbs.
Very, very well put. It absolutely right. And like I said, it's a noble program, but it's a shame that you have these people who will just exploit people for their own personal gain, because this is nothing else but their own personal gain. And,
yep,
you know, I got to give McDonald's credit. They, you know, because this guy's a franchisee, right? So, but right away they said, look, this is not something that we condone, and we're going to investigate it. And, you know, hopefully, this guy will be whatever McDonald's does to franchisees. I don't know. You know, at least the corporate guys at least paid lip service to no exploitation,
right,
under the Golden Arches.
Yeah, but so then the big question becomes, did they not, you know, because I've been saying, I think these kids got a true American cultural experience. They have lived for a very short period of time the experience of low-wage workers in this country.
Exactly. I mean, I was listening to Jorge, who the guy, young student from Argentina, who had said he wanted to come and learn about America, and he really hadn't had a chance. But, you know, actually he did have a chance, and it was not the lesson that we would like people to learn about democracy and fairness and all those things that we trumpet. he kind of saw the what goes on every day, the exploitation of low-wage workers who don't have unions, don't have anywhere to turn. Boss can fire them at will, can cut their hours if they do something that makes them mad. All the things that happen to American low-wage workers are happening to these students, and it just gives us a, you know, they learned the hard way that, you know, America's sort of got this side to it that's not always what's portrayed in the history books.
Yeah, what I'm hoping, Rick, is that we learn from them. Because, you know, they've been here a couple of months, and they, across language barriers, across cultural differences, they figured out how to come together to stand as one and to say, you know what, we're not going to put up with the exploitation. We're not going to be put up with the long hours. The one girl told me 25 straight hours they made her work. We're not going to put up with it. And I think we as Americans should take heed of that.
Absolutely. I mean, instead of just sitting back and saying there's nothing I can do about it, there is something you can do about it. It's called organizing, and that's what these kids did. They found an organization that would support them, and that's what American workers need to do. Instead of taking what the boss gives you, look, people are making record profits, but middle-class wages are being cut. Lower income wages are being cut. The productivity we're now seeing going down because people are just trying to do more with less. I mean, it's the only way you get corporations to share the productivity gains that you give them as a worker is to organize a union. That's the only way you get back some of that money is to go to the bargaining table. And that's what unions do. We bargain so you don't have to beg. And that's what people need to do. They need to learn from these kids that they don't have to take it anymore. They can stand up to greedy corporations and greedy bosses and say enough is enough.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest. I give these kids credit because, and they're cognizant of the fact that they know they're going home in a very short period of time. They could have just kept their mouth shut, taken the abuse, and left and said, you know, I'm out of here. But they almost to a T said, no, look, we don't want the next kid who's going to come here on this program to be exploited in the same way. And, oh, by the way, we don't want the people who live here to be exploited in that fashion either.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, when we were first contacted by these kids that were working out at the Excel plant that was subcontracted by Hershey, you know, the thing they said is, you know, we're almost done, but we don't want this to happen to other kids. And, you know, that's always been the spirit of solidarity, that we band together not only to protect ourselves but to protect each other, because the only person that's going to help you is that worker standing next to you, or that worker that's coming down the road.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania FFL-CIO. On the same day that the J-1 students made their complaints known, we also went out to the Reading area to stand with workers at the Hoffman Industries plant who have been locked out now for 2 years. And the reason I bring this up is, you know, you look at how badly broken and how fractured our labor laws are, that one, we're going to allow the exploitation of these kids and from other countries and our own workers, but also give these employers the power to say, you know what, we're just going to kick you to the curb and you have no real recourse other than to stand there. Something needs to be done on the legislative part of this as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, our labor laws are outdated. You know, the employers have figured out ways around them. You know, they use delaying tactics. You know, the strike and the lockout, they used to be powerful weapons that workers could withhold their labor, and a company, because of the skilled work or because of the need for having its production continue, would usually come to the table and settle, and things would get worked out because the company realized the value of those workers. Well, I mean, this was a company, a national company, Hoffman Industries, that decided they were going to start offshoring some of their production and move some of their production to another factory because they didn't like what the union was asking for, and basically just stripped the plant. Sent it out, changed the working conditions, locked the employees out, the union members out, and they've been, and I'll tell you what, there were guys that there were there 43 and 50 years and 30 years, and they said the baby was the guy who had worked there for 19 years. Now, that's some skill and experience that I think people, that company probably misses and probably is not as profitable as it used to be because of, as a matter of fact, the guys told me that their plant, when they were working there, they were the most productive, profitable plant that Hoffman Industry had. But because they didn't like you, people being in a union, they gave up profits in order to bust the union. And but I'll give these guys credit. They have stood together in solidarity now for 2 years. When we celebrated that anniversary, they were out there in force. All of them came in. I mean, they manned that picket line every day, the lockout line. On that day, they all showed up in the snow and the rain and the cold weather to commemorate 2 years of being locked out. And I just hope that, Hoffman Industries people are never going to change. And, you know,
but we need the community. We need the community. We need people like you and like me and the folks who are out there to stand with them so that they can make it that extra day.
Yep. One day longer and one day stronger. And hopefully at some point Hoffman will realize they do want to make a profit. And when the economics start to hit the owners, and it's a family-owned company, then they may decide that they have to go back when they can't buy their $1,000 suits or whatever it is that the Hoffman folks buy.
Yes, insane. Lastly, on the legislative front, I know the budget's coming up. I know the assaults on pensions are coming up. What else are you guys working on?
Well, we're hearing that they're going to try to move the wine and spirits privatization bill out of committee next week. I'd encourage all your listeners and folks to call their legislators, tell them, no, let's keep alcohol out of the hands of minors. Let's not use alcohol to fund our schools. Let's keep 3,500 good-paying union jobs in the state where they can the profit motive doesn't get into who they sell liquor to. The law gets into who they sell liquor to, which is not minors, people over the age of 21. And we got to protect that. So I'd ask all of your listeners to make those calls to their state legislators in the House. That's where some action's going to begin.
Call your representative. Call them early. Call them often. All righty, Rick, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
My pleasure, Rick, and it's good to be on the show.
Thanks so much, Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Firefighters, my friend, and the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not going to break tonight, and we're not going to bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town.
Earth, sky.
They might not go out and buy a shiny sports car, but chimpanzees and orangutans can experience a midlife crisis, just as humans do.
That's according to a study published in late 2012 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It suggests that, as in humans, chimpanzee and orangutan happiness follows a U-shape that is high in youth, falls in middle age, and rises again into old age.
A team of primatologists and psychologists from Japan and the United States studied 508 great apes in zoos and sanctuaries across the world. Keepers, volunteers, researchers, and caretakers who knew the apes well were asked to assess their well-being. The apes' happiness was scored with a series of measures adapted from human subjective well-being measures.
The researchers are trying to understand why human happiness follows an approximate U-shape through life. They said their study of apes showed that it can't just be because of mortgages, marital breakup, or mobile phones. Apes also have a pronounced midlife low, and they have none of those.
The team points out that their findings don't rule out the possibility that economic events or social and cultural forces contribute to the well-being U-shape in a human lifespan.
But these researchers say their study suggests a need to consider evolutionary or biological explanations as well. That's our show for today, made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show. I give my head to the new constitution. Think about for the new revolution. It's not free that the change all around. Think of my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees and pray.
We don't get fooled again. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. And if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there from the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone, take the program on the go. You know, so I look at these two situations, and it just came up in talking to Rick about, you know, the guys who have been kicked to the curb at Hoffman Industries, locked out. They want to work. They want to go to work. They want to do their job, what they've done for the majority of them, 40, 50 years on the job. You want to talk about loyalty? You want to talk about dedication? That's it. Who's not the loyal one? Well, the one that kicked these people to the curb. And then you juxtapose that with these J1 students. And you go, what's going on in this country with regard to work? And I said from the beginning when Obama took office, my hope for him would be he would be the guy who would save work in this country, save the reward, so that, like my grandparents' generation, you could start out with nothing and at the end of your life do very well and share in the wealth that you create. And, you know, as I said earlier, look, the recovery happened. It's just we didn't get any of it. We didn't see it. Wages have declined. Benefits have been taken away, and what you've got, and I point back to Rand Paul's rant on the drones, invoking Lochner, saying that, you know, Obama's a big opponent of going back to the days of Lochner. He said that, you know, I would ask him, among other things, to rethink the Lochner case. It was a wonderful decision. It was a wonderful decision in that they used it as the justification to do away with anything that you or I fought for. Think about that. We said as a community we wanted to have minimum wage. No, you can't. We wanted to not have children working in mines and in the looms. No, can't do that. We believed in family values that said, you know what, maybe you shouldn't be working 70, 80, 100 hours a week. No. You're compelled as long as your desperation makes you. And, you know, I go back to this and I think, you know, because what they want you to believe, and it's such a nice tale. It's such a nice story in that, well, it's, you have the liberty of contract. You have the liberty to make your own deal. And while that sounds fantastic, throw in the fact that you've got kids to feed. Throw in the fact that we're bringing in people from all around the world, the J1 students, for instance, who aren't supposed to be competing for those jobs. But guess what? They are. So the conditions keep going down and further down and further down until the point where you're willing to work 25 hours in a day. You're willing to work in hazardous conditions. You're willing to breathe toxic air for a buck, $2 a day. I mean, this is where we're going. This is where Lochner will take us back to. And here again, I'm the believer, you know, this was decided law, but it's not decided law to the wealth class. Not at all. They truly, truly want the reins of complete and total power. And to me, that's what Lochner is. It's one of those last pieces that give us any hope of having the ability to bargain on fair ground. Because we say, you know what? This is a line in the sand. This is where nobody falls below. And to me, that's what the minimum wage should be. Should be that line in the sand where you say, you know what? No one in our society lives below this level. We're not going to allow people to be forced to compelled to work 25 hours. It's just not right. And it's not the kind of place that I want to leave for my kids. And I know it's not what you want either. Which is why, you know, it sounds fantastic. Like a lot of these right-wing arguments, they sound so simplistic and they throw out those nice words like freedom and liberty. Yet, really, the freedom here is the freedom to go hungry, the freedom to be exploited, the freedom to be crammed into a basement, 8 or 9 people to a basement, and having $300 a month deducted from your wages. And as I've been saying, the company town didn't leave us. It just moved to the suburbs. You know, I'm still kind of freaked out by the woman who said she didn't care. Just kind of freaks me out. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. That's where you get the podcast or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. Quick break, right back. Want a glorious war? Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
From Rick Perry to Rick Santorum, many Republican sparklies reject the science of evolution. Georgia Representative Paul Brown, who ironically serves on the Science Committee, even calls evolution lies straight from the pit of hell. But while they diss evolutionary progression, the GOP as a whole seems firmly committed to devolution as its own operating principle. Webster's Dictionary explains that to devolve is to degenerate through a gradual change. Synonyms include to crumble, decline, regress, sink, worsen. The party's leaders are presently in an intramural tussle over how they should cope with last year's electoral drubbing, especially by women, Latinos, and young voters. Tea Party Republicans argue for going deeper into the right-wing weeds by promoting a new McCarthyism focused on the bugaboo of a United Nations takeover of America. Others insist the party simply has a packaging problem, so they're seeking softer ways to say, kill Medicare, and studying how to say, cut taxes for the rich, in Espanol. But few, if any, are saying such things as this: government must have a heart as well as a head. Or this: we must conserve and safeguard our natural resources for the greatest good of all, now and in the future. Or this: the purpose of the Republican Party is to build a dynamic prosperity in which every citizen fairly shares. 56 years ago, under the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, Republicans not only said sensible things like that, they put them in their National Party platform as pledges to the American people. How far they've devolved, huh? This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the last thing Republican leaders want is advice from someone like me, but here it is anyway. If you ever hope to evolve politically, ponder going back to the future. You're welcome.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Let's find out what's going on in Washington and around the world. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So the big jobs numbers out today. A good step in the right direction. Still a loss of teachers and cops and firefighters. Austerity working on the government level, it looks like.
Yes, but nevertheless, they were better than expected, and generally speaking, yes, you can argue with these jobs numbers, but you can't argue when the projection was 160,000 jobs, and the actual was 236,000 jobs, and you had a reduction in the unemployment from 7.9 to 7.7, and they don't believe it was because people gave up. I think that's actually a good news story.
Well, I mean, I've always said, you know, the consumers eventually are going to get tired of not spending, and eventually they'll go back, and that's what drives employment, people spending things, getting back into the economy. Just a thought.
Well, absolutely. Now, there were various pieces of this. One of the interesting, there were very robust auto sales, which was interesting. Also, home sales, residential construction, new home sales jumped 16% in January.
Wow.
To the highest level since July 2008. And builders started work on the most homes last year since 2008.
Could it be that the homes that have been foreclosed on have been abandoned for a couple of years and they're now rat infested and falling down and no one can afford to get out from the mortgages that they've got? So the only option for homeowners or potential homeowners is to buy new stuff?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it depends whether you're a glass half empty or a glass half full kind of guy.
But if
you're buying a new home, you've got to get a mortgage, and these things aren't that easy to get.
Right. Well, good.
So I think there's some good news here.
Good news. Yeah, hey, I'm all in favor of good news. I just can't wait for the sequester cuts to go into place and to undo all of that good news.
Well, this is the thing, and I've been pointing this out to some talk show hosts today, which is that March, I think, is going to be iffy because you're going to get some nervous Nellies.
Right.
That's an English expression.
No, no, I perfectly understand it.
Do you have that expression over here?
Sure.
Oh, you do. Oh, good. I'm so glad because I am an American citizen, but sometimes the things I don't know. I've been one since 1995 now, 18 years. Oh, my God, 18 years. That's terrifying. 18 years now I've been an American. Some things I still don't know. Anyway, we get nervous Nellies, and I think we might get some nervous Nellies in March, but I think by April it's just going to be wet willies.
Yeah. Well, no, see, wet willies I knew from being a kid. I think that's a kid thing.
Yes.
But for 45 years, I've been an American, and there are still a lot of things that I don't know. And if you ask some of my listeners, they claim I don't know anything.
Well, you know.
Oh, come on. I see. Well, that's good. I'm happy to see that. We need to be getting in the right direction. I just wish that these sequester cuts will not go into effect, because I hate to see all those people lose their jobs, but we know it's coming.
Well, here's a piece of good news for you.
Hit me. More good news. You are just the bearer of great news.
I am. Well, you may not think this is such good news. I have some right-wing Tea Party-type hosts who maintain vociferously that they're actually not cuts and defy me to point to any money that's been cut and say they're not cuts. It's just that they're... we're just not growing as much.
Yeah, I mean, that's defying the idea of inflation. That's saying, well, you know, wages aren't going to go up and the cost of materials don't go up and the cost of doing business never goes up. So by us, here's the question. You know, I'll give you an example. You know, 20 years ago, I was working, throwing boxes at a shipping dock, making $15 an hour. Let's say I was still making $15 an hour. Did I not get any new money, or did I lose money?
Mm.
Because you think about $15 an hour back in 1989 was a decent wage. Today it has been eroded by inflation. So, I mean, I love how they do that. Well, we're spending the same amount of money. Yeah, but you did that a year ago. Costs for everything, for electricity, for all of the things go up. So to make that argument that, well, you know, we're not really cutting anything is on its face a bold-faced lie, because why are we talking about taking corrections officers out of their prisons? Why are we talking about furloughing people 22 days from the Toby Hanna Army Depot? Those aren't cuts. Those 5,600 civilian workers in that Army Depot,
I made that point, but they're saying that that's just a game that's being played.
It's not just a game. When you're taking money out of something, even if the overall amount stays the same from last year, you're still talking about a reduction in what you can use. And I love I have a friend of mine who says that, well, you know, the rich people, they pay all the taxes because they pay such a big number. And I go, but as a percentage of their income, what are they actually paying? I mean, I guess it's just, like you said, it's the half empty, half full. It's how you're looking at the numbers. You know, somebody said, you know, lie to me with using the numbers. This is one of those examples. Where I'll go with this is in 6 months, when those folks have lost days and lost money out of their pocket, and they end up losing their homes because they couldn't keep up, or the local community starts shutting down because that money's out of the local economy, then let's have that conversation.
That's a good point.
That's or the next time a guy goes to lock up a prisoner in a federal, high security federal penitentiary by himself, like happened not this Monday, but the Monday past, and ends up getting beaten to death and murdered because he had no backup, then come back and tell me, well, you know, we didn't really cut anything. I'm sure that will be very comforting to this guy's family and to the next person's family.
Yes.
And for the border, if you want to talk to the T-Twits, for the border, the people who are like, oh, we love the Border Patrol people are seeing furloughs as well.
I know.
So, you know, again, you know, it's nice to have your talking point, but at least understand it.
I know.
Just my thought. Sorry.
I understand.
I didn't mean to yell at you.
No, I think you're making very valid points here.
Let's something the Tea Party. I hope the Tea Party people and I can agree on. Pretty angering that we now have too big to jail banks.
Yes, too big to jail banks. This is so interesting. And Eric Holder admitted this on Wednesday. I don't know whether he intended to, but whether he intended to or not, he actually did admit it on Wednesday. And then the Senate Banking Committee had a hearing about it on Thursday. And wow, did they let rip. Basically, and it wasn't just Senator Elizabeth Warren, although she was one of the ones who really went at it. There were several others who went at it as well. Basically, what they were talking about was they had the regulators there, Treasury, Federal Reserve, these guys, and they wanted to know, why is it that these really big banks do really bad things and nobody ever gets prosecuted?
Good question.
So answer that.
And what was the answer?
Well, we don't prosecute people. The Justice Department prosecutes people.
Of course.
Yes, but there are things you can do, and why is it, why do you think that is? And what is your opinion? Why does this never happen? And they just went for them. They went for them like rats that haven't eaten in a month. Even Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, Republican, the only Republican at the hearing.
I think that's a bipartisan issue. It should be a nonpartisan issue. These are the people who collapsed our economy. And the thing that bothers me, and I guess to use the Elizabeth Warren frame, you know, I think about, you know, the woman in California who, I think it was California, who stole a bag of cookies from Walmart. And she's gonna probably do a year in jail. So you got this person who, a little bit of something, they're gonna, a year. The big bankers who take $1 billion in cookies, nothing. They can go sleep
nothing.
In their own bed.
No, HSBC got, I think it's a $1.9 billion fine. And as Elizabeth Warren said, well, they go home to sleep in their beds at night. And they've been doing money laundering for Mexican drug cartels and violating sanctions with Iran and Syria. And they knew they were doing it for years.
Yeah, well, you know, we need the campaign cash, Victoria.
But the thing is that what Eric Holder admitted, and these Federal Reserve guys said, well, I don't know if it was the Fed or Treasury or the controller of the whatever it was. Don't know which guy it was said it. They admitted that they have to factor in the size of the bank and whether it's likely to impact the national economy or the world economy before they take action.
Which just that statement alone should be, we need to break them up immediately before they get any bigger. Because if they're too big now, what in another year, 5, 10, what's it going to look like then?
Well, they gobble up all the little banks. You know, they're going to gobble somebody else up tomorrow.
You know, I said from the very beginning, when this whole collapse happened, the best thing that we can do is take the banks over, nationalize them, break them up, and make them small competitive banks. You know the one thing big banks hate?
What?
Competition. You know the one thing the big corporations hate? Competition. What? You know what competition does? It ruins their profits.
Yeah, and this is supposed to be, we're supposed to be a so-called free market economy. Tell that to, what is it, American Airlines, and who did they just merge with?
Yeah. You know, I mean,
US Airlines.
Exactly.
US Airlines.
But, you know, the thing is they, you know, they preach competition to you and me. We should be competing in the marketplace. What competition means for you and me is lower wages. What it means for them is lower profits. So that's why they don't engage in it.
That video, that viral video on wealth inequality.
Yes.
I put it in my news notes, and my friend Shirley watched it. And she's somebody who could vote Republican. She didn't because she's so disgusted. She didn't vote Republican. But she watched it, and she is like, she's ready to go to Hugo Chavez's funeral.
Which I understand was today.
It was today. That's correct.
But, you know, the thing is I'm not against voting for Republicans as long as they're decent ones. And I haven't been able to find any decent Republicans lately. And I keep telling my Republican friends, take your party back to somewhere near sanity. Just a little bit closer away from the edge, please.
Senator Mark Kirk.
Okay. You know, if that's your guy, all right. You know, He's a good guy.
He's very good on human rights.
Okay, you know what I would love to see again is bring me back the Eisenhower Republicans. I watched the drone spiel with Rand Paul, and look, I'm with him on the drone thing. I think there should be some oversight. I know John McCain not so thrilled with it, but I thought Rand Paul went off on some really crazy tangents, especially his wanting to go back to the days of Lochner. But the other part of it was, you know, one of those just kind of scratching your head, going all over the place.
Yeah, and he was really launching a presidential bid.
Really, do you think he's got any shot of that?
No, I don't think he's got a shot of winning, but I think he's got a good shot in a Republican primary.
Yeah, not good. But no, the thing is, you know, he kept bringing up, and the reason that I brought up Rand Paul is, you know, he kept bringing up Lincoln and Eisenhower, who were Republicans. And you go, yeah, but those two Republicans are not recognizable in today's party.
And didn't Lincoln suspend everybody's rights during the Civil War?
Don't say that.
I mean, I'm not an expert on American history, having been foreign in a previous life, but that's one of the things even I know.
Yeah, and the greenbacks thing, and would not be recognizable. And my favorite quote comes from Eisenhower. You know, anybody who would come out against Social Security, unemployment, labor laws, their numbers are negligible, and they're stupid. And the sad reality is stupid has taken over that party. And a good portion of the Democratic Party as well. Don't get me wrong. They're all on the same boat there, in my view. But anyway, so the Chavez funeral, I saw a report from the righties telling me the lefties are so happy. I don't know that I'm happy in celebrating Chavez that much.
I think that a lot of people had a lot of issues with Chavez. I don't know that he was actually a hero to the Democratic Party, to be perfectly honest with you.
No, and I see these pictures of these people crying and wailing in the streets, and I guess I've just never, and I don't know what it is about areas around the world where that happens, because I don't know that that would happen here. Not that, you know, we're uncaring or unsensitive. I just don't know that you would have throngs of people, you know, wailing in the streets.
No, I don't think you would, but I think that he symbolized something to many people there, and I think that he helped poor people and gave them a sense of hope in a way that politicians don't do over here.
Right.
He symbolized something.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, we'll see. And I understand there's some good news on the, we're going to be maybe at some point allowed to videotape policemen stopping us. Cause I got to tell you, whenever I get pulled over, I would love to be able to have a camera there just in case. Cause you never know where things go.
Well, I don't know where it's going to go, but the Justice Department has filed a statement this week in a federal court in Maryland urging the court to affirm individuals' rights to record police under the First Amendment. It's a statement of interest in support of a journalist who I know extremely well, who is suing over his arrest while photographing Maryland officers. They were arresting two men, and he thought they were using excessive force.
Yeah.
And so the DOJ says that not only do individuals have a First Amendment right to record police officers doing their duties publicly, they also have a Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment right protecting them from having those recordings seized without a warrant or due process, as happened to Manny Garcia, as he was then roughed up and had his camera taken away and his battery and video never returned.
I mean, if they get to record me, why can't I record them?
turn about to fair play.
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, at the end of the day, and I wish, you know, from when I was a younger man, I wish I would have had the recording of my arrest, but that's a whole other story from another day. They wouldn't give it to me, though. But if they can record me, I should be allowed to record them.
I'm with you.
Simple.
This is supposedly an open society.
There you go. Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Thank you. You too.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A bill currently winding its way through the Minnesota legislature could double the amount of money struggling families receive from welfare grants. Jesse Russell reports.
Currently, a family of two on the Minnesota Family Investment Program can expect to receive assistance at the same level as in 1987, $437 per month. According to the Welfare Rights Committee, 70% of the individuals on the program are children. Angela Bushner is an MFIP recipient and member of the Welfare Rights Committee.
You got to look at your son and you say, maybe ask for a scholarship or something because I don't have the money to do it.
The bill passed the Senate Health, Human Services, and Housing Policy Committee on Monday. Some lawmakers had attempted to live off of $51 per week, and on Tuesday, each reported they'd found the task to be impossible. Representative Susan Allen didn't need to take the challenge because as a single mother, she lived off of the assistance while trying to put herself through school.
That gave me an opportunity take care of my son.
A dozen workers at a nonprofit collective in Minnesota are on strike, seeking resolution of workplace grievances by insisting on their right to collectively bargain as a unit of the industrial workers of the world. John Snortum is one of the IWW workers at Sisters Camelot, which provides free food to low-income people who need it. Snortum says Sisters Camelot isn't respecting its workers, and despite being a collective, it's resisting true collective bargaining for its canvassers. The canvassers do door-to-door fundraising for Sisters Camelot.
The real issue that comes down to me is that they don't respect us as a part of Sisters Camelot. The way I see it is that they think Sisters Camelot is the collective, when really, you know, we raise 95% of the funds for Sisters Camelot, and they cannot do it without us.
The IWW Sisters Camelot workers have a list of demands and are attempting to negotiate them. The collective said in a statement that the workers are trying to force the collective into the role of boss. Then the collective acted very boss-like by firing Shug Mississippi, one of the IWW workers. Snortum says it's strange that a collectively run organization is resisting collective bargaining for workers.
Yeah, it is really strange, you know. The behavior that they're showing is a clear sign that they are drawing straws and that they're unwilling to give up any power that they hold.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. To keep worker and union voices on the air, go to laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to cut the waste so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors.
Penthouse to the basement. Well, in this situation, you look in the penthouse, you have the corporate master, and in the basement, nine J-1 students, nine workers. And as I said, look, you know, the company town didn't leave us. It just moved to the suburbs in a house that looks like anyone that you or I or any of our friends would live in. Something seriously wrong. And when those students stood up and said no, what was the first thing that the boss did? Tried to throw them out of their house, out of their basement. and tried to use the police to do it. Sad stuff. Brian sent me an email during the break. He said the sad reality is we only get outraged when it hits home. But as you point out, an injury to one is truly an injury to all. He says, get ready, Americans. 25-hour shifts are in your future if we don't fight this now. And I absolutely agree. I've got our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, good to be here, pal. How are you?
I am angry. I'm furious. I'm outraged. I look at, again, another one of these J-1 scandals, another situation where you've got kids from around the world coming to our shores, coming to our state, saying, you know, we want to experience the American dream. We want to experience America, and they're getting screwed.
Well, it's hard to imagine that this is happening at all. It's even harder to imagine that it's happening here in the United States. And it's downright breathtaking that it's happening here in Pennsylvania. But I'm thunderstruck that here we are, a scant year and a half later, and it's happening within spitting distance of the last time such an event took place in the United States of America, when we had this same fight for all of the same reasons over in Hershey,
yep,
August a year ago. And I was with those J-1 students when that event took place. As a matter of fact, the Hershey police, the gendarmes who had taken into custody Rick Bloomingdale, the president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Kathy Jellison, the president of SEIU Local 668, the Pennsylvania Social Services Union, and Neil Bisno, the president of SEIU Healthcare in Pennsylvania, had all been arrested, and I was literally at the jailhouse trying to get them out when the police were concerned that the several hundred J-1 students who had the temerity to say that they wouldn't work under these insane illegal conditions, not to mention have this perversion of the reason that they came here to the United States to study and learn and interact with people. Police got concerned that those kids were going to riot.
As they should, but you know, I'm thinking, as they should. I mean, there should be outrage, and we should be standing with them.
Yeah, and today we were. Again, as we were then. The leadership of Pennsylvania's labor movement stood with them shoulder to shoulder and solid. I know President Bloomingdale was there again today when another round of J-1 workers, this time employed by McDonald's in the Cumberland County suburbs of Harrisburg, were pulling the same garbage and once again trying to enlist the support and the help of the local police to not arrest the law violators, but to take control of the kids and to throw the kids out of their living quarters because they had the temerity to speak up and ask the question of why was this happening to them in the United States of all places.
Let me ask you this, Erwin, because, you know, it was a couple hours later that the bully, you want to talk about bullies, you want to talk about thugs, the guy that was the manager who came out and I say assaulted several of the people who were there, went back to that dwelling on Maple Street just blocks away from the McDonald's there on Trindle Road and threw those kids, would not let them back into the quarters that they paid for and paid $300 a month, nine of them, $300 a month to live in a basement, mm-hmm, denied them access. Is there anything legally binding? I mean, you're throwing people out of the place that they rented.
Well, there's a landlord-tenant law in Pennsylvania. And before somebody can be evicted from their dwelling under Pennsylvania law as a tenant, as a renter, generally there is a procedure and there has to be notice. There has to be a minimum amount of notice. There has to be an opportunity for a hearing before an independent body, typically a district magistrate. And once the district magistrate has heard a case and renders a decision, if it's in favor of the landlord, there has to be an additional period of time before the order of possession that would come from that is permitted to be converted into a writ of possession. And it's only after a writ of possession is issued that a landlord is allowed to repossess property from a residential tenant. There's a very plain, very specific, very detailed, statutorily created procedure. It's a matter of a law passed by the General Assembly, signed into law by the governor, that is aimed at assuring that landlords who have a lease agreement that's being violated have their rights protected, but that people who are paying rent for living in a dwelling have their rights protected. Because we as a commonwealth, remember this is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, have a fundamental interest in prohibiting, restricting, limiting, and stopping homelessness. And that's what this person was created. But
even more than that, Erwin, to me, this act was terrorism. This act was...
Well, I think it is. I think it is exactly that. It's residential terrorism, and that's exactly what I've characterized it at in other situations. But at the same time, this guy who was the manager of this McDonald's store is himself a working stiff who is merely just like the copper bosses and the coal bosses and the coal and iron police of another generation right here in Pennsylvania. And the Pinkertons were conscripted and enlisted by the robber barons and the tycoons and the captains of industry. And
well, to steal a quote from Jay Gould, the railroad magnate of the 1880s, 1890s, yeah. I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half.
Yeah.
We saw that in action, I believe.
I think so, too. And that was you've just summarized my point far better than I've been able to do today. I suspect that manager who engaged in unconscionable conduct today.
Yep.
Was directed to do that by a boss, and I'm sure that boss is paying that manager something next to nothing.
But giving him the power to be able to do what he is doing. And I look at this, and the stories that these kids told me, the nine of them living in this basement, four girls, five boys, separated by a curtain. And whenever the McDonald's needed somebody, the way it was explained to me, they would come down, roust them out of bed, whatever time of the day or night, and get them over there. It's at-will employment, but at-will slavery employment, in my view.
Well, it's wage slavery, and not even good wage slavery. And to think that this is happening not in some backwater coal patch in East Nowhere, Pennsylvania, but literally...
A stone's throw from the Capitol.
A stone's throw from our Capitol. The bastion of democracy. The bastion of freedom. Give me your tired, your poor, and I'll make them more tired and more poor.
You're right. We should be changing that inscription on the at the foot of the of Lady Liberty.
Yeah, this is. I mean, it shocks the conscience. It offends fundamental and basic sensibilities, and all the while the neatly scrubbed children are being chauffeured to the Camp Hill schools in their mommy and daddy owned Mercedes SUVs. And stopping off, by the way, at McDonald's on yep. the way home from school to get a little bit of a snack.
And I stood and I watched them do that, and I watched them deliberately look the other way. And to me that, and I had a woman tell me that she didn't care. She was giving me this roll in the eyes and huffing and puffing. I said, do you know what's going on? And she looked at me and said, quite candidly, I don't care. You're disrupting my lunch.
Well, and you know what? The best thing that happened out of this is that the activity today did take place, and a light is being shined on it. And just about half an hour ago, I got an email, and it shows me that this is not merely a local story, but this has already gone national.
As it should. So the question that I have is, you know, here we are, a year and a half, two really very major situations like this. How pervasive is this abuse of the J-1 program? And shouldn't we be considering not allowing it to continue in its privatized form?
Well, very clearly, this is a shining example of what privatization really means. That when we convert taxpayer-financed programs from public oversight to private greed, something breaks. And in every instance, it is humanity that breaks. Every instance, every time, every place, every turn. And unlike the people at Hershey who pretended to turn a blind eye to all that happened because they said, oh, gee, it wasn't us. It was this other company. Now we know that it wasn't this other company. that it was the franchise holder of this McDonald's.
And several others, in talking to the, it's all around the area. And then the question is when do we get to know where these kids worked at? And what I want to know is, why am I not allowed as a citizen to know where these J-1 visa students are being placed? Why is it I can't, why is that information not available?
Well, buttress that question with how much less are we going to know because of sequestration and programs that get slashed and burned and cut and enforcement that winnows away and dwindles simply because and exclusively because first we decided to privatize, then we decided to cut back. So I think you're quite right. Where does this stop? Where does it go? How does it end? When does the exploitation become itself the victim?
Because these kids, everyone that I talked to said they their entire lives, they looked to this country as the example, as the at the top of the hill. This is what we aspire to be. We want to be like Americans. We want to come and experience what it's like to be a proud American and what it's like to pursue that American dream. They came here with wide eyes and eager to learn about our culture. And as I told one of them, you now know what it's like to be a low-wage worker in this country.
Yeah. Well, one of the intriguing things of my experience in the Hershey battle of not all that long ago was when our friends and colleagues were arrested and incarcerated for engaging in free speech and for engaging in very mild and modest civil disobedience by sitting down on a public access road. And the police came to me and told me they were very concerned, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, about this 300-odd member group of kids who had been the victims of exploitation and they're concerned about a riot. I said to the police officer and the district attorney at the time who were there talking with me and negotiating over the terms of the release of the Hershey 3, that, you know, fellas, you just incarcerated the only three adults involved in all of this stuff. And you took them away in handcuffs in front of those 300 odd kids.
Yeah.
And they all come from countries where when somebody goes away in handcuffs, they never get seen again. So if you don't give me back my people so that I can take them to a place where these 300 kids are assembled so that they can see that the people who stood up for them are safe and secure and in my custody and not yours, I can't tell you what's going to happen. And one of the realities is the kids that you met today in this McDonald's mess, the kids who had the courage, without having common languages, without having citizenship rights, without having much of anything other than the clothes on their back, to engage in a work stoppage, those kids with all of that courage doubtlessly had a similar experience. And had they seen anybody carted off in handcuffs, or when the boss comes around and beats on the door to rouse them to tell them it's time to go to work even though they just got off of a 12-hour shift, or when that same boss says, I'm not letting you back in your living quarters where you have all of your belongings on this continent, they have a very different view of that than you or I or our listeners who have lived in this country forever have.
Yeah.
Because they know that human nature is what it is. And sometimes human nature can't be balanced against the paper on which laws and regulations are written.
You know, I got to be honest. You know, I was in awe of the courage of these kids because, you know, they weren't fighting for themselves and they knew that. Mm-hmm. They knew they were going back home at some point in the near future. And, you know, a lot of people would just say, you know what, screw them. As soon as I'm done with this nightmare, I'm done with it. But they actually think about the next generation, the next J-1 visa student coming into this country. And, oh, by the way, their coworkers who are at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder in this country, they want to see them do better as well.
Yeah.
That, to me, just that says a lot about these kids.
I think it speaks volumes about these kids, and I hope that our own kids here in the States see this and learn a lesson from it about convictions and courage and principles and about knowing that sometimes injustice is so fundamental that you must speak out and you must act.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Irwin, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time, and thanks for the insight here.
Thank you. Thanks for asking the questions, and thanks for bringing me on. And next week, we need to visit a couple of huge decisions that have come down this week from the Pennsylvania judicial system. So I'll leave that hanging as a tickler for the next time I get a privilege of being on your show.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Irwin.
Thank you. Take good care.
Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
They might not go out and buy a shiny sports car, but chimpanzees and orangutans can experience a midlife crisis, just as humans do.
That's according to a study published in late 2012 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It suggests that, as in humans, chimpanzee and orangutan happiness follows a U-shape that is high in youth, falls in middle age, and rises again into old age.
A team of primatologists and psychologists from Japan and the United States studied 508 great apes in zoos and sanctuaries across the world. Keepers, volunteers, researchers, and caretakers who knew the apes well were asked to assess their well-being. The apes' happiness was scored with a series of measures adapted from human subjective well-being measures.
The researchers are trying to understand why human happiness follows an approximate U-shape through life. They said their study of apes showed that it can't just be because of mortgages, marital breakup, or mobile phones. Apes also have a pronounced midlife low, and they have none of those.
The team points out that their findings don't rule out the possibility that economic events or social and cultural forces contribute to the well-being U-shape in a human lifespan.
But these researchers say their study suggests a need to consider evolutionary or biological explanations as well. That's our show for today, made possible in part by our friends at Futurity.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about the potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money.
Even if it's been money
for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'll tell you, this is one of those days where you go, you just cannot believe, that woman just, wow. I mean, if I was, strangling came to mind. You just go, wow. To look somebody in there and go, I don't care. I don't care about them. That just speaks volumes to me to where we have come as a nation. Because I truly believe, it's my views on things. That, at the end of it, what I want is I want all of us to do better. It's just, so much of this just leaves me shaking my head. And as we see numbers coming out, we see study after study, wages are declining. The last thing I just saw, the real median income in the U.S., adjusted for inflation, in 2007 was almost $55,000. $54,489. 2011, that had dropped all the way down to $50,000 a year. That's the median income. And to me, what it says is what we're allowing to happen is all of this exploitation at the bottom, which is pulling us down. So if you need a reason to support these kids, or you need a reason to support the Hoffman guys who have been locked out for 2 years in the Reading area because the boss said, what, you're not going to take a pay cut and you're not going to pay half of your salary for health care? To the curb with you. We're done talking. 2 years to the curb. At some point, we've got to turn around and go, you know what? What happens to them? What happens to those kids at that McDonald's? What happens to those kids at the Hershey warehouse? What happens to those workers at Hoffman? What happened to those workers at Castlewood out in California? Could happen to any one of us at any time. And you look at as the stock market has hit its absolute pinnacle since the Depression, what's happened to wages? What's happened to people's benefits? What's happened to working conditions? And I go back to what I said to one of these J1 kids this morning. I said, unfortunately, what you're getting is a cultural experience that you didn't want, but you're getting it anyway. This is what happens to low-wage workers in this country. It's this kind of exploitation. It's this kind of abuse. Maybe not as extreme. Maybe not 25-hour shifts without being paid. Well, no, wait a minute. Come to think about it, I do know people who have worked 25 and 30-hour shifts. Yeah, me! Back when I was a young man, it's what we've allowed to happen in this country because we haven't drawn that line in the sand. We haven't said no. What we've allowed to happen is we've allowed ourselves to be exploited, and it's no wonder that an employer like this McDonald's thinks that. And I tell you right now, I'll bet you the guy who owns that place is saying, well, I'm giving these kids an opportunity. Shouldn't I be rewarded for my wonderfulness? Shouldn't I be thanked for giving them a place to stay, even if it is, almost $3,000 a month that he's putting in his pocket? I'll bet you he believes that he's the benevolent one. He's the one being attacked because that's what we've allowed the wealthy in this country to think, that everything that we fight for, everything that we work for, somehow they give it to us. They bestow it upon us because they're so benevolent and wonderful. And if it weren't for them, we would be just standing around. We've allowed that to happen, and we've allowed it to happen by turning our backs on our neighbors, by turning our backs on our coworkers, and turning our backs on what's going on to these kids as well. And I'm hoping that the light bulb goes on very soon, that you hear the story, and you go, you know what? That could be me. That could be my kid. That could be someone that I love. And you say no more, and we draw that line, and we say never again. It's that simple. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the first hour of the program, you can download it there at thericksmithshow.com. Or if you've got the Stitcher app on your smartphone, you can take the program on your go. Take a quick break. Back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
Hello, I'm Mark Boulanger. Front page news this week is all about Wall Street setting new records. The latest Dow Jones Industrial Average has passed the previous record set in 2007. But while the same financiers and bankers who caused the 2008 economic crisis were celebrating, there were some voices pointing out that unemployment figures have remained staggeringly high. The International Labor Organization, the ILO, estimates that there are about 197 million unemployed workers in the world. Over 75 million young people are looking for work. The ILO is the UN agency concerned with matters of work in the world. Guy Ryder is the Director General of the ILO.
It's great if the financial world is feeling better about life, but the fact of the matter, from the world of work, things are getting worse. The ILO's figures show that in 2012, 4.2 million more people joined the queues of the unemployed, and our projections for the next 2 years are for more to join them again.
In New York, 6,000 people are attending the UN's 57th session of the Commission on the Status of Women. The theme of this year's conference is violence against women and girls. Some 200 union activists are participating in the conference. One of the delegates is Denise McGuire. Ms. McGuire is the president of the World Women's Committee of UNI. UNI is the Global Union Federation for Skills and Services. She is also the vice president of Prospect, the union for professionals in the UK. I asked her how widespread the problem of violence against women and girls is.
It's huge. It's all over the world. One thing you can say about violence, it doesn't discriminate. Race, class or creed, no matter how rich you are, how poor you are, well-educated, wherever you live, whatever country, millions of women and girls are trapped in violent situations. And there's one fact that gets quoted, and I can never believe it, but amongst women aged between 15 and 44, violence causes more death and disability than cancer, malaria, traffic accidents and war combined. And that's a staggering figure.
What are the worst forms of this violence?
I don't really like to get into a, well, this isn't as bad as that, because it's all really horrible. But I would guess, let me tell you a tale. Yesterday, I had a couple of young volunteers from one of the unions, and they went to a parallel event where there was a discussion about rape and abuse of women and girls in conflict situations. When they came back, they were kind of physically shocked. I mean, you could see they were sort of in a state of shock because of what they'd heard. It was way beyond their experience, and I just wish it was way beyond everybody's experience. You could also talk about female genital mutilation, and it's estimated there's between 100 and 140 million women who suffer from that. There's trafficking of women and girls for sex. There's also trafficking of people almost into slavery. I think there's been a recent case here in New York where a very wealthy woman is actually on trial for basically having held a domestic worker captive in the house. But violence against women, it covers sexual violence, physical, mental, psychological and economic, and it really is widespread and it's outrageous, and we've really got to put a stop to it.
What can governments do to help fight violence against women and girls?
The first thing is proper labour legislation so that women are not vulnerable. And that's important for all women, but it's incredibly important to women who suffer from the double discrimination. So women are racial equality according to their sexuality, disability, etc. So legislation in place to protect women, and legislation enacted becoming a reality so that governments can make businesses adhere to it as well, so that women in particular, but I mean it does impact men, aren't in fear of losing their jobs because of the effects of domestic violence, for example. And they need to put some money there. They need to finance programs to protect women and girls.
You can hear an extended version of my interview with Ms. McGuire on the Radio Labor website. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity forever.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
You put on gonna shut them down!
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Jan emails me with just one word, unbelievable. And it is. I mean, we just went through this with the Hershey Company, just went through this whole, the same scenario, and yet here we are, within a stone's throw of the Capitol. The exact same thing. So I wonder, you know, how much of this is going on in neighborhoods around this area. I mean, I walked onto Maple Street where these kids live in the basement of this house. And I go, you know, that's a neighborhood that I would live in. How much of this is going on? How pervasive is this? And the other question is, what if it were my kids? What if it were your kids? Something seriously wrong, which is why I've asked a couple of the kids to come talk with us. I've got Jorge Rijos. He is here from Argentina, here on that cultural exchange program, experience that he was looking for. He's gotten an experience. Jorge, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, how are you?
Tell me what the action today, what prompted it?
Well, basically we realize that we have been being exploited by this person, our employer, because we came to realize that we paid between $3,000 and $4,000 in the case of the Asian girls to come here to do this cultural exchange, and we found ourselves living in our employer's basement, paying him rent for those basements, and at the same time working for him in conditions which were only suitable and profitable for him, but we realized that they didn't care about the experience we were having here, which was supposed to be an experience to interact with Americans, right, to learn about your culture, to travel around, to visit places, to, you know,
so
what I mean?
Would it be safe to say that your expectations of this program have not been anywhere near what you had hoped for?
Exactly, because this was supposed to be an opportunity, like I told you, to interact, to travel, and we didn't have chances to do that. We've been here basically just working all day, being on call for them because they want us to be on call, because we are basically, like one of our coworkers, American coworkers, said, we are their little slaves. They can just, whenever they need us, they will have us working, and when they don't need us, they won't. So there's a contract in between that established that we would have transportation to the workplace, we would have rooms, and none of those were fulfilled. We are living in a basement. We have to walk to work, which is actually not
too long. It's a dangerous road.
Yeah, it's dangerous because, this is different in our countries, but here it's mostly, at least in this area, it's mostly highways, so there are no sidewalks. And it's very dangerous because cars pass us by, and really drivers don't pay much attention to people walking because they don't expect anyone walking around. Everyone has cars here. I mean, it's really rare to see people walking.
And not to mention that the path that you had to walk to get there, it's a non-pedestrian path where you could be ticketed every day for crossing the street because there's a sign right there that says no pedestrian.
Exactly. We recently knew that we are actually, committing some sort of crime or fault, I don't know how to say it, because we're not supposed to be walking around those areas, let's say. So we could have gotten arrested because we were walking around in those places.
Yeah, or at least find. Let me ask you this, Jorge, in looking at this from before you got here, what were your hopes? What were your aspirations? What did you think you were going to gain from this? Because as you told me, you don't come from a wealthy family. This was actually a struggle for you to come here and take part in this. What were you hoping? What were the dreams that you'd had coming here?
Well, back in Argentina when I was there considering this idea, it sounded like the perfect chance to come to the United States because we had the chance to recover the money that we were investing. So that played a major role in my decision, let's say, because I said, okay, I will invest this money, but then I will get it back. Plus, I will learn, I will see the American culture with my own eyes, I will experience it. So in the end, I got none of those.
Let me ask you, you know, and as you were growing up, and you told me an interesting story as you were growing up, thinking about our country, thinking about, you know, coming to America. You know, what were your ideals as a kid when you were looking at the United States? And what were your thoughts of this country then? And then compare that to how you feel now.
Well, when as a child, I grew up in the 90s, and in Argentina, we got to see lots of TV programs from the United States, so we have like a very positive view, let's say, on the United States. And then as I grew grew up more, let's say, like at school we learned some things which are rather negative as regards the United States, so I didn't want to be a prejudice, so I want to see with my own eyes what it was like. But unfortunately, the aspect of the American culture that I got to see, of course, I'm aware of this. It's just like the worst, the not the nice part of it, let's say. I know there's so much to America than what we've been put through. I know that there's, I mean, we actually met a few people in the little times that we had. We met a few people, even at the McDonald's, we had like chances to speak for a very limited amount of time with people, and they are very kind, very generous, and they are actually very friendly. So that's the part of the American culture that we all were expecting to see. So we wanted to share our culture. Also, we often want to speak about what we do, what we believe in, and like a real culture exchange. That was right. The whole idea of this program.
You wanted to take more away from your experience here than other than being able to say, do you want fries with that?
Exactly. That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So the action today, which I thought was a really powerful event, I thought it was well put together. I thought that you got a lot of community support out of this. Where do you go from here? I mean, I understand that the people who are living in the basement of one of the houses, the one on Maple Street anyway, they have been turned away from their home. Has that changed at this point?
Well, before I answer your last question, I would like to tell you that one of the aspects that is very worrying about this is that as a student, I mean, these people are employers. They have everything very systematized, let's say. So to the point that we all started internalizing that we were going through was okay. So they are counting on the fact that we are here for only 3 months, so that we will just, like, we will decide to just resist and wait for this to end and go back home. That was actually happening to us. But somehow we said, no, we have to do something about this. And that's how we came in contact with the people from the National Guest Workers Alliance. And they were actually the ones who responded the fastest and the one who started helping us. And they are helping us right now, actually. And, yes, we organized this. I mean, we got organized and we decided to do this because we think it's important not only for us, because we could have just said, I mean, some of us are leaving in a week. So some of us are leaving in 2 weeks, but we could have said, no, let's just, resist a bit more and this will be over. But we decided that this is important because if we don't do anything about it, it will go on happening. Yep. And no one deserves this.
Nope.
Even even less so if you are being misled, let's say, if you're being deceived because they promised you something. You paid for something, and then the experience has nothing to do with what you were promised.
Yeah, and I give you guys, and as I told them, the number of the people that I talked to today, I give you the utmost credit for looking out for the people who may come behind you, because it would have been easy to say, I'm going to do my week or two or whatever, and I'm getting out of here, I'll put this behind me, and the heck with the people behind me, and the heck with the people who, the American workers who have those jobs. I give you guys credit for standing up and saying we want to make it better, not just for ourselves, but for the next guy behind us and behind us.
Yes, we actually know that our employer is bringing more students from Asia next week. And we said, no, we have to do something. We don't want them to go through this. And we know exactly what is going to happen. So we don't want them to have to suffer as we have suffered these mistreatments.
Jorge, hey, I appreciate the time. When you go back to your country, have good thoughts about our country. There are good, decent people here in this country, and not everyone is... like the person that's doing this.
Don't worry. I know that we were just unlucky to end up with these people, and it's just their greed that unfortunately is overshadowing. I don't know if that's the term. Sorry, my English is not that good, but I guess the idea is that they are like overshining or overshadowing,
overbearing, and overpowerful, and all of those things.
Everything that is good about the American culture. So. Thank you for giving us a chance to tell our story. This shouldn't happen.
I'm right there with you. I appreciate it, Jorge. Let's go to Alicia Marim. She's from Paraguay, one of the folks today at the event, and one of the workers who is in the process and is being exploited. Alicia, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi. Tell me
your story.
Okay. Well, and I come here the same guy and to the exchange culture, but they give me a lot of hours to work, and I don't have any choice. And when they say, and we need you here, and I need to stay there, I can leave the work. They say, no, call out. Or the first time was in New Year, was in December 31, and was my day off, and they come to my house, and they say, hey, we need you because we don't have any people to work today. And I say, well, but we can come again and like at 8 in the night because we have a dinner tonight. And they say, yes, sure. And then was 11 and 11:30, we are working, and we don't have any dinner for New Year. And then was like a four time again, they say, no, you need to stay. And my schedule was like three p.m. to 11, the last day. And then the next day was like a 6 to 3. And then they say, no, you need to stay to 11. And we stay all this day working, with just one break in the morning, one meal, and they say that I can, you can move in your position because it's busy now, and I can go in the bathroom. I can take a drink, like a water or nothing, because I'm the cashier. And they just say that you don't move. You need to stay. You need to stay there.
That's horrible, Alicia. You know,
yeah.
Let me ask you, before you came here, and I'll ask you the same question I asked Jorge, what were your expectations? What did you think this was going to be? What were your hopes that this would turn into?
Well, I just...
Not this, right?
Yeah, no, because in my contract, say, 80 hours for 40 hours per week is 8 hours per day, and now every day. No Sunday, Saturday, or whatever is my day off. But and this week my schedule was like I don't have any day off. And yesterday they say me that I need to stay there, and I say no. I don't want to stay here. I'm tired. I want to go home.
And now, do you work more than 40 hours? I mean, are they paying overtime, or do they not even do that?
No.
So just, they're breaking even the most basic of labor laws, not even talking about being decent people. They're just blatantly breaking all the laws then.
Yeah, because they drive me to my house, and when I say, no, I don't want to stay, they say, okay, go walk into the house because I don't drive you today.
That's horrible.
And I need to stay, and I work like a 15 hours, and the last time when I say no was, no, we need you, and my manager said that, and it was like a, and he wants to put in my mind the people, the students every time come here, and they work, and he say, the Asian people, they don't sleep. They just work. And I say, okay, but I don't want to work too much. I'm tired too. I want to go in my house.
You want to experience, you want to do what you came here to do, which is experience our culture. And some would argue that you've experienced what it is to be a low-wage worker in this country. So my question for you is, when you return to Paraguay, what are you going to tell the people about our country? Because I can't imagine that you came here expecting to be exploited like this. Yeah. What are you going to go home with?
Yeah, when I go again back in my country, I say, oh, wow. I need my bed because I can feel my legs. I can feel my feet because I stand up every day, and that's crazy. Because
it is crazy.
Here is just working, and they say this is American. The people here working every day, just work, and I say okay, but I want to sleep too.
Yeah, well, I'm assuming this has been a real experience for you. But I hope that when you return to your country, you won't think that all Americans are like the handful that you've met there. And last question I've got for you. Are you one of the residents at the Maple Street house with the eight or nine people in the basement?
No, and I saw the because we are all friends with the students. But I live in the Kelker Street, and it's a house. But my case is that they give me a lot of hours. This is my protest.
Right.
Because they give me a lot of hours, and I don't have choice. And the last time when I say no, and I told like 1 hour and a half with my manager, and I cry, and he say, no, you don't understand me. And I say, no, you don't understand me. I'm tired.
Now, have they threatened to send you home? Have they threatened repercussions beyond saying we're not gonna take you back to your apart to your home or we're not?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I wish you nothing but the best, and I appreciate the fight that you're putting up, because look, you're saving the next you behind you from having to deal with this. Alicia Marim, I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you, guys, for support. Really.
You're welcome. Thank you. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
I look look at this, and again, you know, we just went through this whole fight. And what blows my mind is, you know, did we learn nothing from the Hershey situation? You know, I'm sure it's just, you know, it's more of the same actors with just different names. And just like with the workers in the situation at Hershey, I think these kids need to be made whole. They took out massive loans for them in their countries to come here to get that experience, to get that cultural exchange, and then be able to make a little bit of money. Look, they're not saying that they shouldn't work. They're not saying that. They're saying they shouldn't be working at exploitative situations. And, you know, you think about it, I wonder, and I would love to see one of these contracts. Because, you know, I was reading the Penn Live comments. It just blows my mind at some of the ignorant comments you get on there. Because I think it is when people just throw dumb things out there just to be contrary. I mean, you've got some folks who are like that. But I would love to see one of these contracts. But more importantly, I would like to know how many of these employers are amongst us. How many of them are around? Because it's still, I mean, it's still stuck in my head. You walk down that street, and it's suburban America. The company store, the company town is right there in suburbia. And I wonder how much. And as I was asking some of the people from the different groups who were there working with these kids, you know, where's the oversight? You know, how does this all work? And evidently there's a private company that, because we've privatized this, because, you know, hey, like our friend Erwin Aronson said, you know, with the sequester and all the cuts and cuts, the oversight's gone. And I was told there are 8 inspectors throughout the entire country that oversee this program. The entire country, 8 people. And that there's no database for me to, as a citizen to go, okay, well, let me see where these J-1 visa students are working. Where there would be an organization to go, you know what, we're going to check up on this. We're going to hold these employers to account. Because you stop and think about this, and we learn the exact same thing with the Hershey kids. These employers, they bring these kids in, they pay them minimum wage, and then they charge them through the nose for living expenses. So while you go, hey, I'm going to make $7.25 an hour, and wherever we're from, that's probably a decent bit of change. We'll be over 3 months, we'll easily make the $500 or the $4,000 back to pay the loan. We'll have the experience. We'll have worked a little bit, and we'll be able to go home with a couple of bucks in our pocket. It's a win-win situation. Then you find out that they're charging you $300 a month for a part of a basement, not even a room. And then they're charging you for everything else. Nickel and diming you to death until at the end of the week you go. And I remember the Hershey kid showing me his check after 40 hours of work, 88 cents. Mind-blowing. And yet, the woman says she didn't care. I mean, that's going to stick with me for a while. And look, I understand you got a bunch of yuppies running around who all they care about is themselves. They feel it's never going to be them. And the reality is as long as we as a nation think, well, it's never going to be me, we're pretty much guaranteeing ourselves at some point it's going to be. Because understand, we're all in the, whether you like it or not, we're all in the shark tank. It's just a matter of when our number is. You know, when we're going to be the flavor of the month. And I look at all of these stories across the country of, you know, like I said earlier, the median income gone down over the last 4 years, almost $5,000. That's wealth that has been taken from you and me. And of course, given upward. And we see the studies, but you don't need me to tell you what the studies are. You're living it. We're all living what's going on, which is a theft from the working class to the very wealthy. And we're using kids like this to pull us down even farther, even faster. And while, you know, in talking with those two kids, you know, I hope they go back to their country and they say, you know what, I got screwed in this experience and I got screwed by these people. But as a country, people there are decent. and the respect, because understand, these are going to be the ambassadors. These are going to be the leaders of the next generation. And by us allowing them to be exploited just makes no sense on a whole number of levels. It's just flat wrong. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on out in the Reading area. This Hoffman Industries kicked their employees to the curb 2 years ago because they didn't want to sit down and negotiate for a contract. So they said, there's the curb. You're done. Another example of our broken labor laws. Quick break. Right back.
Con in conservatism. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A bill currently winding its way through the Minnesota legislature could double the amount of money struggling families receive from welfare grants, Jesse Russell reports.
Currently, a family of two on the Minnesota Family Investment Program can expect to receive assistance at the same level as in 1987, $437 per month. According to the Welfare Rights Committee, 70% of the individuals on the program are children. Angela Bushner is an MFIP recipient and member of the Welfare Rights Committee.
You got to look at your son and you say, maybe ask for a scholarship or something because I don't have the money to do it.
The bill passed the Senate Health, Human Services, and Housing Policy Committee on Monday. Some lawmakers had attempted to live off of $51 per week, and on Tuesday, each reported they'd found the task to be impossible. Representative Susan Allen didn't need to take the challenge because as a single mother, she lived off of the assistance while trying to put herself through school.
That gave me an opportunity take care of my sons.
A dozen workers at a nonprofit collective in Minnesota are on strike, seeking resolution of workplace grievances by insisting on their right to collectively bargain as a unit of the industrial workers of the world. John Snortum is one of the IWW workers at Sisters Camelot, which provides free food to low-income people who need it. Snortum says Sisters Camelot isn't respecting its workers, and despite being a collective, it's resisting true collective bargaining for its canvassers. The canvassers do door-to-door fundraising for Sisters Camelot.
The real issue that comes down to me is that they don't respect us as a part of Sisters Camelot. The way I see it is that they think Sisters Camelot is the collective, when really, you know, we raise 95% of the funds for Sisters Camelot, and they cannot do it without us.
The IWW Sisters Camelot workers have a list of demands and are attempting to negotiate them. The collective said in a statement that the workers are trying to force the collective into the role of boss. Then the collective acted very boss-like by firing Shug Mississippi, one of the IWW workers. Snortum says it's strange that a collectively run organization is resisting collective bargaining for workers.
Yeah, it is really strange, you know. The behavior that they're showing is a clear sign that they are drawing straws and that they're unwilling to give up any power that they hold.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. To keep worker and union voices on the air, go to laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Show. So over the weekend, the folks at Keystone Progress held their Pennsylvania Progressive Summit. There are a lot of really good panels and a lot of good workshops to attend. And a couple that I wanted to go to, I wish, you know, there was more time that you could go to most of them, or at least had the opportunity to view them somehow. Maybe next year they'll work on that, putting them online, that where if you couldn't be there, you'd be able to still get the information. And one of them was on gun safety and all of the misinformation, all of the heated rhetoric. You know, how do you decipher through what's true, what's not, the confusing policy, all the things around it. How do you do that? It's one of the ones that I'd like to have seen, which is why I've asked Shira Goodman, executive director of Ceasefire PA, who had done a panel there at the summit about this, to come talk to us. Shira, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, it's one of these things where there's a lot of heated rhetoric and what I don't know most of the time what's true. I get a lot of emails from my NRA friends. Obama's taking guns. Yet I can find no policy. I can find no law, no legislation. It's just a blind faith or just, well, a lie.
Well, I think that, right, there's this fear that any changes in the gun laws will lead to that ultimate, you know, slippery slope of they're taking guns. And really that's not what's on the table anywhere. What's being discussed are expanding background checks, harsher penalties for trafficking of guns and gun crimes. They're talking about bans on certain kinds of weapons, but almost every proposed law that I've seen would grandfather in existing possession of those weapons. So there is, you know, that scare tactic from the gun lobby that any change in the law will ultimately lead to list of gun owners and confiscation, but that's not real. It's not based in reality. It's not what anybody that I know or work with is talking about.
Yeah, the whole confiscating guns, I've not heard anyone say, but, you know, I thought it was already decided that there were things that we couldn't have. Like, I can't have a stealth bomber or a howitzer, or I can't have a nuclear weapon or any of that stuff, can I?
No, I certainly hope not. And you can't have a fully automatic weapon, and that's for years and years. But we're talking, and then, you know, but the 1994 ban on certain kinds of assault semi-automatic weapons expired. But that also had a grandfathering provision, so all the weapons that were available before 94 weren't taken away. And then once that expired in 2004, people were free to buy them again. So and that's a challenge in if some kind of ban is implemented. Can it be as effective with all those guns still out there? But I think that's the kind of thing that gets that rhetoric going and that kind of blocks compromise, because the gun lobby has just scared people into believing that that's what's going to happen. And people who want change and who want common sense regulations really have to try and find common ground and be very clear that nobody's talking about undoing the Second Amendment or taking away guns. We're trying to keep illegal guns off the street and out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them.
Yeah, I'm with you. But how much of it do you think is people's misinterpretation of the Second Amendment? Because I have friends who truly believe that they should be allowed to have any munition that they want, that they should have the right to bear the howitzer or whatever, that's what that gives them, that right.
Well, I think what happens is people look at those, a small part of the Second Amendment or, you know, the part of the Pennsylvania Constitution, and they look at those last words, you know, and the Second Amendment shall not be infringed, and in Pennsylvania's Constitution shall not be questioned, and they forget in the middle. You know, the Pennsylvania's Constitution talks specifically about in defense of self or state, and the Supreme Court of the United States has interpreted the Second Amendment to say, yes, you have a personal right to bear arms, but like our other constitutional freedoms, it's subject to reasonable restriction, and people don't like that part about the reasonable restriction. I don't think it's really about what does the Second Amendment mean anymore. The United States Supreme Court has said there's this personal right to bear arms. The question is what kind of reasonable restrictions are there? We know you can have background checks. Like you said, for a long time there have been certain weapons that you just can't possess as a civilian. And we have to have a real conversation about that, and there's nothing in the Second Amendment or the Pennsylvania Constitution that should preclude that.
So what is reasonable? I mean, it's an interesting word, one open to considerable interpretation. What do you view as reasonable?
Well, I view expansion for a background check for every gun sale as reasonable. And I don't mean from a father passing on to his son, but I mean beyond that. If I'm going to sell you a rifle, we should have to go to the store, just like if I were going to sell you a handgun.
Or a car.
And get a background check. If I lose my gun or I find that it's been stolen from wherever I keep it, I should have to report that to the police. Right now in Pennsylvania, we don't have a state law requiring that. Some towns and municipalities have tried to do it on their own, but they've been challenged, and there's questions about whether states where the towns and cities can do it on their own because of the state preemption law. You know, things like making sure other states get their mental health records into the national database, like Pennsylvania just did a few weeks ago. Those are all kinds of things that really do not put additional burdens on law-abiding gun owners, and they do make it harder and cut the flow and the avenues that people who are intent on doing harm, who shouldn't be having guns, it makes it harder for them to get them, and I think that's what we want to do.
And looking at the Newtown shooting, what do you say to those who say it wouldn't have stopped that from happening? Because, you know, we want to stop these horrible tragedies from happening. But what do you say to those who, you know, even this stuff wouldn't have stopped someone who's unstable or really determined to do some of this stuff?
Well, he, you know, we don't know exactly what happened, if he stole the gun from his mother, if she never reported it missing, if she gave him access. So there was some kind of breakdown there. Either she wasn't securing her guns, she knew her son had you know, certainly was suffering under some kind of mental disabilities and emotional challenges and didn't do enough to secure her guns or get them out of the house. And, you know, we know that doctors and psychologists lots of times will tell parents, if their child is at risk, that they should get guns out of the house. She didn't do that. So that is something that would be different, putting that kind of requirement on gun owners. But we also know that, yes, somebody intent on doing real harm does find a way. But if that person had a limit on the size of the magazine clips, he might have been able to not, if he had to reload more quickly, he might not have been able to do as much damage and harm as he did. Right. I mean, when they talk about the bodies of those children, they had multiple bullet holes. And you know, he only shot for a couple minutes. So some of these things, would it have totally prevented everything? No, but it could have minimized damage. And the truth is, just because we can't solve every problem doesn't mean we shouldn't try to solve some of them.
That's an excellent point. Because, you know, what I was going to bring up is, you know, I have someone who tells me, well, you know, there's a mother in Atlanta who, you know, if she would have needed extra bullets to shoot the intruder, then what would you have said? And, you know, there are valid arguments on all sides of this, but at some point, there's got to be some rational thought in here.
Right. We also know, you know, I heard that. I was in Washington when that woman testified about the women who should be home and be able to have as many bullets as they need. You know, statistics show that women are much more likely, if there's a gun in the home, to be killed by a partner or somebody else than to use it in defensively to protect their homes. Now, I'm not saying that women who want to have guns for safety and who are law-abiding citizens shouldn't have them and be well-trained in how to use them and secure them, but I am saying that the facts show that guns in the home do create danger for people in the home, especially for women.
Yeah, I think back to the woman from the Reading area who was in the national spotlight for a couple of minutes because she carried a sidearm to her six-year-old soccer game, and it caught national attention. She was actually ended up being killed by her, I guess it was her husband or live-in boyfriend or whatever it was, while her gun was hanging on the chair.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, so we know that you know, even people who are trained and who are used to it can be overtaken or can have their own guns used against them or might not be able to have access to their gun. So we know that more guns and arming everybody is not the solution. And I was on a show with a police chief a few weeks ago, and he said, a teacher said to him, you know, do you think I should get a gun? And he said, are you prepared to kill somebody? And she said, no. And he said, then you shouldn't have a gun.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a difference, and then I think the conversation has to lead to, there's a difference between the urban mentality and the rural mentality. And I look at myself. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland where if someone had a gun, there was no good coming of that. There was somebody going to get shot, somebody going to get killed. And I move into a more urban area where, you know, guns are part of the culture, where, you know, you went out and you shot tin cans, you went hunting with dad on the weekends or whatever. So there are different views of guns and different uses for them. And is that something that could be melded into policy as well?
I think that it should be. I mean, I think that when people talk about wanting to have access to certain kinds of weapons for shooting, for target shooting, for going to the range, I think that if we work together, we could find solutions to have those available to those people who are sportsmen and want them, but have them secured some way. But that's not even on the table because we can't get to the table together. But I think we should be able to take into account our cultural differences, you know, statistical
problems in our cities and towns versus, you know, our rural areas, you know, places where hunting and people bring, you know, there are places, very rural areas during hunting season where kids drive with their guns to school. I mean, which seems crazy. You know, I live in suburban Philadelphia, but that could never happen here. But I think that if we were really having honest policy dialogue and debate, we could, you know, take it into all that into account, but it's very hard to get everybody to the table to do that.
Yeah, because I've seen people shot, and it's not pretty.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality in this is there are two very different world views on it. And I guess I'm fortunate that I've lived in both worlds. And I think if we were able to see from the other point of view where, you know, one and the other, I think you would then be able to maybe reach some consensus and some common ground on this.
I think you're right. And I think that, it's on both sides that we should be able to discuss what the needs are in our different areas. And that's part of the reason that some of the towns and cities that have passed laws that apply only to their cities are so frustrated when the courts rule that they're preempted by state law, because maybe one size doesn't fit all in Pennsylvania. We have a very, you know, geographically diverse state. Our cities and towns are very different. We have a, you know, different kinds of histories, and maybe they should have those, local areas should have more autonomy to make policies that fit their people and the needs of their community.
Yeah, and the people who tell us that they believe in local government and local control are the ones who are trying to use the larger entity to force down on everyone else.
Right. Well, you know, nobody ever said you have to be consistent in what you think, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's what works at the moment. But part of the problem is just not being able to get people to talk to each other. And I think we need to call on our leaders to do it. You know, it's very easy for them to go up there and say, you know what, nothing's going to happen, and I'm not going to take the tough votes, or I'm not going to force my people to take the tough votes. Well, I didn't elect my representatives and senators to not take tough votes. You know, if I wanted them to just go to Harrisburg and D.C. and do nothing, I would have voted for somebody else. I mean, I want them to go and take tough votes and do the work that we sent them there to do.
Yeah, see, I did vote for somebody else, so I can't make that argument.
Okay.
Anyway, so are you seeing anything being done? I understand today there was a gun trafficking bill in the Senate that was moved forward. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's important because I don't think that just having new regulations is the answer. We do need to have tough criminal laws and penalties so that people know if they have illegal guns, if they traffic in illegal guns, that they're going to face real consequences, and that give our police and prosecutors tools to get the big fish if they need to. And so I think that those are really important. And the fact that we don't actually have a federal straw purchaser bill on the books or a trafficker bill, that, and this will do that and give a mandatory minimum, I think that's important. And I think these are the kinds of things that if we can package with an upgraded regulatory system, will really help. We need strong criminal penalties, and we need judges who are going to give tough sentences to people who violate gun laws.
Yeah, I'm with you. So what do we do? I mean, what's the call to action?
I think the call to action is that people need to make their voices heard. They need to call and email and write their representatives, both in D.C. and Harrisburg, and let them know they care about this, that it's not going to be okay to let time go and nothing happen, that we want to see some reasonable solutions like these trafficking bills, like expanding background checks, and that we expect them to come and have hearings and let us be heard. But that's the key thing, I mean, because we know that people on the other side have been single-issue voters, have been really good at getting their message out, and we need to do that too, because our voices have been kind of diffuse on lots of different issues, and that's important because we care about lots of different things. But if you care about this issue, you need to tell them, because it's very easy. You know, they want to know that people from their constituency who can vote for them, they want to know what they care about. So if you care about it, you got to tell the people that represent you, whether or not you voted for them, because they still work for you.
Yeah, they need that political cover, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I understand at your website, ceasefirepa.org, you've got a pledge you want folks to take.
Right. If you take the pledge that you want to take a stand against gun violence in your community and your state, you can sign up. You'll end up getting our emails. You'll get our action alerts and petitions and suggestions of when to write to your legislature and legislators and how to do it. And it's always best, obviously, for people to customize their notes, and so that legislators see that different people care, and you tell them about what you care about. But we do have a way you can put in your zip code if you don't know who your representatives are, because, you know, sometimes it does change with those redistricting things.
With the gerrymandering, yeah.
Yeah.
Call it what it is.
We try and do that. We're trying to give information about what's happening on the federal and state level, and just really give people those resources to find out about it and to keep talking about it.
And while it's good to go to ceasefirepa.org, I am still a fan of taking a pen, writing on a piece of paper, signing your name on the bottom, putting it in an envelope, putting a stamp on it, and sitting it on their desk. They do hold on to those, and it's going to help out our post office.
I think that's right. And also, you know, picking up the phone and calling. They will ask you where what your zip code is, where you're from, and they do track it. You know, we hear from them, you know, when they're hearing from people that care about what we care about, or we hear when they're getting calls, a lot of calls from the other side. So it is really important not to let up that pressure or that encouragement, or just to say thank you to somebody who's, you know, made a statement or said something in the paper or come out in support of something that you care about.
Absolutely. Sure, Goodman, I appreciate the time. Executive Director of Ceasefire PA, ceasefirepa.org, the website. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Sure, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
A proud defender of a working-class majority. Rick Smith.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555. Or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
From Rick Perry to Rick Santorum, many Republican sparklies reject the science of evolution. Georgia Representative Paul Brown, who ironically serves on the Science Committee, even calls evolution lies straight from the pit of hell. But while they diss evolutionary progression, the GOP as a whole seems firmly committed to devolution as its own operating principle. Webster's Dictionary explains that to devolve is to degenerate through a gradual change. Synonyms include to crumble, decline, regress, sink, worsen. The party's leaders are presently in an intramural tussle over how they should cope with last year's electoral drubbing, especially by women, Latinos, and young voters. Tea Party Republicans argue for going deeper into the right-wing weeds by promoting a new McCarthyism focused on the bugaboo of a United Nations takeover of America. Others insist the party simply has a packaging problem, so they're seeking softer ways to say, kill Medicare, and studying how to say, cut taxes for the rich, in Espanol. But few, if any, are saying such things as this: government must have a heart as well as a head. Or this: we must conserve and safeguard our natural resources for the greatest good of all, now and in the future. Or this: the purpose of the Republican Party is to build a dynamic prosperity in which every citizen fairly shares. 56 years ago, under the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, Republicans not only said sensible things like that, they put them in their National Party platform as pledges to the American people. How far they've devolved, huh? This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the last thing Republican leaders want is advice from someone like me, but here it is anyway. If you ever hope to evolve politically, ponder going back to the future. You're welcome.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup. Stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in a wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the numbers are coming in. You look at the fact that the student debt bubble being blown up every day exceeded $1 trillion this year from what reports are saying. And you know, I saw in the president's State of the Union, he said, you know, we need to have universal preschool for everyone. We need to get people educated because, you know, that's the direction the country needs to go. We need educated folks. And I remember the next day on fake news on Fox, you had one of the commentators who, in talking about the president's plan to make sure that kids get a good start in life, had this to say.
I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day you can't afford it, we can't afford it. To say preschool for everybody, are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that.
We don't have the money for it. Yet the next day I saw a story, Stanford University raised $1 billion for their endowment. So the question is, do we not have the money or do we not have the will to make sure that every kid gets an education K through 12 and on into college? And this bubble, what's it doing to the next generation? Which is why I've asked Scott Ross of One Wisconsin Now. He was one of the presenters at the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit this weekend. It's just another one of those things that I really wanted to go to, which is why we've asked Scott to come on the program. Scott, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, thank you so much for the kind invitation.
You know, I look at this bubble that's being blown up that even my generation, and I'm only 45, we weren't saddled with this kind of debt. I talk to kids in their 20s and in their 30s, and they're going, man, I am just weighted down. I can't even buy a car for the love of Pete.
Well, yeah, and I mean, we did some original research on, you know, things like that, middle-class purchasing, like home ownership, like new car purchasing. And the results were absolutely shocking and should be frightening for anybody who is interested in America digging its way out of the economic depression that we were in and moving forward with a strong middle class.
But here again, what we're looking at is we're looking at the selling of the next generation down the road, and we're seeing it in just about every aspect of life, you know, be it on the job or be it in the classroom or in the tax world.
Well, I think so, and I think that the, you know, with in particular with student loan debt, it is this $1 trillion debt crisis. It's a confluence of all the failed economic policies that pro-corporate conservatives have been trying to sell the United States for the last 30 years that over and over again have failed the middle class. And this student loan debt is literally, we believe, the next third rail of American politics. And as more and more young people try and go out in the workforce and are unable to get their slice of the American dream because directly attributable to student loan debt, you know, maybe now is the time when something will finally get done about it.
Yeah, I remember I brought this up about 5 years ago because I had been reading the, you know, the tea leaves and reading people's reports going, this is coming, start paying attention. And I did, and I remember having conversations with people who said, you know, my age and a little bit older, said, well, you know, I had to have debt. I had to take out a loan to get an education. Why should they get it free when I didn't?
Well, I think the thing is, and you know, it's understandable because, you know, a lot of this stuff happened with little fanfare. But what we have to acknowledge, recognize, and change is the fact that privatization was introduced into the student loan system in the 1990s, in the mid-1990s. And from there, Wall Street and the banks were able to lobby a pliant Congress to take away literally every consumer protection for student loan debt that is afforded every other commercial transaction.
Right.
And that is why we believe, you know, we believe that one of the reasons that student loan debt has grown so vast is because, you know, parents weren't and students weren't really told about the kind of system they were entering.
We were all told, Scott, this is the way to the middle class. The only path to that middle class existence that my grandparents, who barely had an eighth grade education, were able to attain, the only way I was going to get there was a college education.
And absolutely. And what's despicable about the current messaging on this, when you do hear conservatives talk about student loan debt, is, well, maybe some students shouldn't go to college. Maybe you should just go for, you know, a year or so and get, you know, the training you need and then get out into the workforce and get these jobs that, you know, these manufacturing jobs or whatever that don't seem to exist in a lot of places, you know, every place from Pennsylvania where I grew up to Wisconsin where I live now. And the fact is that education is the pathway to a good middle class existence. Unfortunately, we're making students become virtual indentured servants to student loan debt, and it's because Wall Street got everything that it wanted.
Yep.
The federal and state governments reduced the amount of investment they made in higher education, and the minimum wage hasn't kept up, so that, you know, my mom, who worked in the Butler Mushroom Mine in the 1960s to get through college with virtually no debt, that doesn't exist anymore because, you know, if you wanted to work minimum wage, you know, for instance, to afford the tuition at the University of Wisconsin, which is over $10,000 a year and still is the lowest in the Big Ten schools, you'd have to work nearly 10 months, you know, 40 hours a week just to have $10,000 to be able to pay that tuition under today's current minimum wage.
Excellent point. I have a friend who is a college professor, and she said, you know, she worked her way all the way through the University of Michigan system, all the way through her undergrad and through her law degree, walked out of there back in the 60s without a dime in debt and worked as a waitress.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll
to highlight exactly what you said.
You know, I'll give you a good example. Like, you know, in Wisconsin, which has the nation's oldest technical college system, until 1972, that was free. You know, students who went before 1972, you know, didn't have to pay anything.
Right.
And we have changed that because we have reduced the investment in higher education and K-12 education to pay off things like, you know, the Reagan tax cuts from the 1980s, the Bush tax cuts from the 2000s, and two wars that were put on the credit card.
Yeah, and you brought up Reagan. To me, most of this really, I mean, some of it started before pre-Reagan, but it was really pedal to the metal during the Reagan years. And especially, I go back to when he was governor of California. California universities used to be free until he came along and changed that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we saw, you know, with the, you know, the tax breaks that began to be doled out in the Reagan years. I mean, we saw the corporate income tax cut rate be cut by a third. We saw the top personal income tax rate, you know, cut by over 50%. And we simply don't have money because our elected officials, those in power, are allowing rich people to get away without paying what their fair share should be in a progressive tax system. As simple as that.
And what we're seeing right before our very eyes, to use one of my Tea Party friends' favorite terms, is we're seeing redistribution of wealth of epic proportions.
Absolutely. And again, it's the middle class that has to pay the bill, because it's the middle class it's middle class students who are being saddled with this student loan debt. And, you know, one of the shocking figures that we found in our survey, and this was a survey of 2,700 people with student loan debt, people without student loan debt, people of all income strata, was that if you have a student loan debt, you are two-thirds more likely to buy a used car than a new car. If you have a student loan debt, you are two-thirds more likely to be a renter than own your own home. And in fact, what we found, this shocking statistic, in the state of Wisconsin, people, you know, 86% of people earning between $50,000 and $75,000 a year, which is a good salary, 86% of those renters, of people who are renting as opposed to owning, have a student loan debt.
And the other part of this is even if you're making $20,000 or $10,000 a year, it can't be discharged. You're saddled with it, and it keeps growing and growing, even if you can't pay.
Yeah, there is literally, I mean, there's no statute of limitations. I was at a conference right before I went to the one out in Pennsylvania, and one of the guys was talking about basically we treat student loan debt the same way in terms of statute of limitations that we treat treason and murder. You know, those are the three things that you cannot, you know, the statute of limitations simply does not in any way, shape, or form have an end date to. And, you know, when we think about what businesses are allowed to do and what wealthy people are allowed to do,
yep,
and then you think about, you juxtapose that with what the student loan rules are. For instance, you know, I consolidated my student loans back in 2000. And unfortunately, the rate at that point in time was 7.875%. Less than a year later, interest rates were 1.99%. I am forbidden by law from being able to reconsolidate my loan. All student loan people are unable to, you know, refinance their student loans as the market rates fluctuate. So a lot of us are paying, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% when interest rates are, you know, virtually zero at this point in time.
But Scott,
and it is a national crisis.
But Scott, that's good business. Come on, that's good for business.
Well, I tell you what, I thought what was good for business was people spending their hard-earned money in their communities to buy goods and services in local communities. I thought that good business was young people getting out of college with the entrepreneurial spirit to be able to create small businesses that employ 5, 6, 10, 15 people. But our students are being unable to do that because the average length of debt for a bachelor's degree now is 18.7 years of paying that off. And when you think about the average student loan debt being about $350 a month, you are paying so much more than anybody paid, before, again, before privatization, before the Wall Street banks got all the rules they wanted, so that our students don't have any rights, essentially.
Yeah, see, that used to be how business operated. When my grandparents' generation were in charge of things, that was the idea, what you laid out. This is the new America, Scott. We don't believe those things. We don't believe those things anymore.
Well, I think a lot of people believe them. Unfortunately, there's not enough shows like yours where people are talking about things that are affecting the middle class. You know, we have talking heads screaming at each other, well, should we make a tax cut for the rich people this percent or should it be this percent? You know, we don't think about the middle class, and that is the engine that drives our American economy. It drives it in Wisconsin. It drives it in Pennsylvania. It drives it all over this country. High-wage jobs create a good, strong economy. A good, strong middle class makes America thrive. And yep. That's what we need to get back to.
I'm with you. But beyond all of that, beyond all of the good economic part of it, to me, is the citizens. I want educated, critical thinking citizens so that we don't end up in the position we're in now. And, I find the more educated we become, as my grandfather always said, because he was a street smart guy, never finished eighth grade, the more education you get, the dumber we seem to get.
Well, it's just a matter of, whether or not we allow ourselves to lapse into a debtor's envy.
Good point.
And that's what concerns me. We've got all these young people coming out of college, and let's not kid ourselves. Like, we have been divided on issues late in elections by things like race and LGBT issues. And as our, Generation X is more enlightened than the baby boomers are on that, and the millennials are more enlightened than Generation X. And instead of these divisive issues being able to keep people from focusing on what their economic needs are, we're going to squander the fact that the young people can't be divided on those issues. They can focus on these things, and they're going to be concerned about the fact that they have 20 and 30 years of student loan debt. It's going to program them to be more selfish, unfortunately, about their neighbors, about the community, and about the investment, because they're saying, well, for God's sakes, I've got a 20-year student loan, that I'm paying $400 a month for because I wanted simply to get an education, and I'm being told it's my fault.
Yeah. So what do we do, Scott? I mean, at the end of this, there's got to be a policy where we can turn some of this around and really save it for my kids, because, I don't want my kids to be in that situation. Their college is, 10 years down the road. We throw some money into these 529 plans, which I don't think are going to be enough. And I think a lot of it has to do with a nice tax shelter for the wealthy. What should we be doing? How should this look? How should we be educating our kids?
First of all, there are several prongs to this, and we're not going to solve the problem overnight. What we got to do is we've got to lobby Congress to make sure that we treat student loans the same way we treat business loans. And that is to give the consumers real protection. We need to insist on our state and federal government that they finance higher education according to the cost of higher education today. And lastly, we need to make sure that the priority of government is doing what the vast majority of people need, which is to invest in the public infrastructure and job creation so that when our young people get out of college, they have real jobs and a chance at the American dream.
Sounds good to me. Last question I've got for you, and one of the shocking things that I've heard, and I just wanted to hear you repeat it. We think about student loan debt as something only for, the recent college graduates or, the recently unemployed. But I heard a statistic on the number of seniors who had their Social Security garnished. Any idea what that number was?
Yeah, we had last year 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. And in fact, if you look at percentages of debt acquisition, it's people over the age of 60 whose percentage of debt has grown the most over the last 7 years. It's gone from $7 billion in 2005 to $43 billion as of 2012. So it is a multi-generational crisis, and anybody who has, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students, it's about all of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Scott Ross, I appreciate the time. One Wisconsin Now. Thanks so much.
Rick, thank you. Anytime.
All righty, great. I appreciate it. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Oh, 9% of the world, 10% of the people. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10%.
Hear smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
From Rick Perry to Rick Santorum, many Republican sparklies reject the science of evolution. Georgia Representative Paul Brown, who ironically serves on the Science Committee, even calls evolution lies straight from the pit of hell. But while they diss evolutionary progression, the GOP as a whole seems firmly committed to devolution as its own operating principle. Webster's Dictionary explains that to devolve is to degenerate through a gradual change. Synonyms include to crumble, decline, regress, sink, worsen. The party's leaders are presently in an intramural tussle over how they should cope with last year's electoral drubbing, especially by women, Latinos, and young voters. Tea Party Republicans argue for going deeper into the right-wing weeds by promoting a new McCarthyism focused on the bugaboo of a United Nations takeover of America. Others insist the party simply has a packaging problem, so they're seeking softer ways to say, kill Medicare, and studying how to say, cut taxes for the rich, in Espanol. But few, if any, are saying such things as this, government must have a heart as well as a head. Or this, we must conserve and safeguard our natural resources for the greatest good of all, now and in the future. Or this, the purpose of the Republican Party is to build a dynamic prosperity in which every citizen fairly shares. 56 years ago, under the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, Republicans not only said sensible things like that, they put them in their National Party platform as pledges to the American people. How far they've devolved, huh? This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the last thing Republican leaders want is advice from someone like me, but here it is anyway. If you ever hope to evolve politically, ponder going back to the future. You're welcome.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
We know in days like yesterday and today we have a lot of work to do. We got to make sure that we work with our counterparties, our clients, to get the answers they want, and we're pursuing that as we speak. And we're also exploring other alternatives, such as strategic investments or investors and other financing alternatives. So we have work to do, and we're doing it right now.
What exactly does that mean?
You got to love all the financial mumbo-jumbo. And you know, one of the things that gets me about what Scott Ross was talking about is how well they have done this over the years. You know, I go back, and we were talking about it when I was in college back in the 80s, and you know the debt that I had, you had to pay it back, and you knew you had to pay it back, but it was nowhere in the neighborhood of what these kids are saddled with today, and the wages were considerably higher. And I went back to when I got out of college, I took a job working for a trucking company, throwing boxes on a shipping dock, making $15 an hour as a casual. And you look at what they're being paid today to do the same job. Someone told me it was like $12 an hour. And this isn't adjusted for inflation. This is back in the late 80s, I was making $15 an hour. They're not making that now. Almost a quarter of a century forward. And you look at this, and I go back to my friend who's the professor who said, he worked her way through law school on tips at a local diner there in Michigan. Those days are long gone. And I don't know what kind of, part-time job you get that's going to do that. Can't be legal. And I look at this debt crisis that we've created, and we have created this by pushing it down on the next generation. You look at the statistic I saw, 15% of the K-12 funding comes from the state, which is it used to be at one point it was 50%. So you look at the redistribution that's going on right before our very eyes. All because we've got politicians who say, well, at least we didn't raise taxes. And take great pleasure in saying we gave huge tax breaks to the well-to-do. Instead of investing. But again, I go back and I think about, what conservative world looks like. And a lot of this really, really accelerated during the Reagan years. It was all there. There was a push for it. The business class wanted education. If you go back and you read the Powell memo, and I had an interesting conversation with someone over the weekend about the Powell memo, because, you know, he was one of these guys, well, you know, that was the definitive piece. I'm going, he was one of many that wrote similar type plans. He was just happened to become a Supreme Court justice, which is what gave it such strong weight. But if you look at those plans, it was all taking over education. It was taking over the message at a young age. And they've done a masterful job of taking over higher ed and convincing high school kids that you got to go to college. And parents have convinced their kids, you know, you can't work with your hands because those jobs are going away. And I think back to my grandfather telling me, you know, if you become a truck driver like me, you'll have been a failure because you have the opportunity to go to college. You had the opportunity that I never had, he said. He goes, he couldn't even finish eighth grade because he had to go to work to put food on the table. I mean, you think about that generation who lived the hard life, lived the street life, fought for what it is that we're now giving away. That's what infuriates me to no end. They fought those battles so we wouldn't have to, and yet here we are going, here, no problem. Privatize public education. Yes, because we don't want our taxes raised? Are you really kidding me on that? And the accelerator on privatizing education is the pension fund now. They went and they screwed up the pension fund, something that has been viable for over 100 years. And now they're saying, well, we need to do to public education what private industry has done to industry after industry, which is bankrupt it, cut it off. Let's move to a different entity. And this is what happens when you have business people sitting in the halls of government. Because they don't mind running things. And I thought Scott made an interesting point. You know, the wealthy, they don't have problems with filing bankruptcy or using maneuvers to shed debt. That's no problem for them. For you and me, they make it seem like, well, it's the end of the world. And we've been told numerous times, well, you know, that you're a failure then. Well, it doesn't seem to matter to these big corporate titans, does it? Not at all. And maybe, you know, and I didn't ask Scott, and I wish I would have, you know, what would happen if everyone just said, you know what? All of the folks who are paying 7, 8, 9% interest said, we're not paying it. We demand to have a refinancing. If it's 1%, 1.9, 2% now, we want it at that rate. We want to have those consumer protections, and we're not doing anything until you do. But again, that would take a movement of people willing to stand up and say no more. And I think back to the founding of this country, and I'm waiting for that moment again. You know, we keep hearing the voices on the right say, well, if you raise taxes, there's going to be a revolution. I'm waiting to see the real revolution when working people realize that for the last 30 years, they've been getting the shaft. For the last 30 years, policy has gone against them. We have catered to the ultra-wealthy at the expense of kids' futures. And I, for one, don't want to see my kids saddled with tens or $100,000 worth of debt. I knew a guy, him and his wife, when she was an attorney, he had a PhD. They were each $100,000 in debt. They make a reasonable living, but when you're talking about starting off your marriage as young graduates, $200,000 in the hole, it's ludicrous. What good to our society does that do? And the answer is none. What it does is it harms their productive years, the years that they would be buying a home and buying cars and furniture and all the things that go with being a young startup couple. You've taken them out. And how is that good for our economy? What we're doing is we're taking future spending on that middle class Norman Rockwell existence that we've been sold, and we're handing it over to bankers. And the bankers are ticked that the Obama administration said, well, we're gonna have a federal program for that. Because that profit, really, they want. They lobbied heavily for that. That's theirs. And they're going to fight tooth and nail, you mark my word, to get it back. And one of the other things that I should have asked, and we're gonna get Scott back again to talk about this issue, because where do we go? I've seen studies say that, I've seen ideas, and again, I go back to Milton Friedman. It's the ideas that are lying around that we use in times of crisis, whether it's, you know, it's self-created or it's something that's natural. When this student loan bubble bursts and enough people say enough, we're not paying it, what then? How do we make sure that the next generation gets an education? And I'd heard a good idea. So, you know what? You're going to pay a percentage of your income for X amount of years, and whatever that income is, that's what you're going to pay. If you make $20,000 a year, if you make $20 million a year, you're going to pay that percentage into a fund. That fund is going to fund education. And at a certain point, it becomes self-sustaining to where we now have a source of revenue coming in that is directly funding education. It seems like a reasonable idea to me. There's an X amount of time. This way we get people going into maybe less lucrative. Maybe we don't have a whole bunch of Wall Street greedmongers. Maybe we got people who want to take care of kids in the local neighborhood or take care of my grandmother. Or who knows? Maybe do community organizing and could be president someday. Because even the president doesn't make a whole lot of money. He will when he leaves. But while in office, not so much. There's so much we should be doing. And yet here we are, still talking about the same divisive issues that they've stuck in our face. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break when we come. Ask Me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561. What's he doing? What's he doing? Well, he's holding the door open for a couple of old ladies. That's what he's doing. Well, that's not news. Man, didn't show that clip again, huh? Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. A little labor history today. 1913, William Howard Taft, president at the time, signed legislation that created the Department of Labor. William B. Wilson was named the first person to head up the new department, which was to help labor. Just a thought. Franklin Roosevelt named Francis Perkins to be the first Secretary of Labor. She was the very first female cabinet member in U.S. history. Also today in 1933. And today in 1937, workers... of members of the UAW workers at the General Motors plant there in Flint won their sit-down strike. They won recognition of their union. And again, you know, they go back and what did they do with sit-down strikes? They ruled them illegal. Thank you, U.S. Supreme Court. Using government as a tool. Get them out of my life! Get them out! Get them out! And you look at how our labor laws over the years have been just destroyed and decimated, and you can fire people for just about anything if you just use this at-will employment doctrine. And I just started watching this, and I've been meaning to for a long time, watching this program, House of Cards. And the one episode that I watched last night, the wife of Kevin Spacey runs like a nonprofit, the Water Initiative, I think it was called. And she wanted to fire half the staff. So she tells this woman to, you know, to go in and fire all of them. And she walks in. She goes, you know, so how did it go? How'd the firings go? And the woman goes, well, you know, there were some tears and some, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we basically use the at-will employment doctrine, which got us out of any legal wranglings. And then I loved what the woman turned, what Spacey's wife, what her character, what she turned around and did. So this woman, 59-year-old woman who's the office manager, does all the dirty work, fires all these people, sends all these people packing, and then in comes Spacey's wife's character and fires her after she does all the dirty work. And I guess that there's poetic justice in that. Because, you know, if it were me, I don't know that I could do that. It just is what it is. But you look at the nature of our labor law, and there's something seriously wrong with it, especially with this whole at-will employment doctrine. But had this Christian college in the San Diego area used the at-will employment doctrine, probably wouldn't have gotten themselves into any trouble. The problem was this young woman evidently became pregnant and showed that she was pregnant. So the administration called her in, asked her if she had had premarital intercourse. Obviously, the answer was yes, because she wasn't married and she's pregnant, unless she was going to say some kind of divine intervention. So they claimed that, you know, she violated the school's moral code, which obviously banned premarital sex because it is a Christian college, and they canned her. And the beautiful part of this, and one that I found quite interesting about the story, and it just highlights all of the hypocrisy and the ridiculous nature of these people who run these organizations, after they fired this woman, and she said, look, I felt like I was humiliated. I felt like I was in trouble. She's pregnant. After they fired her, they offered to hire, and you can't make this up. So they fire her for being pregnant because she had premarital sex. Then they offer the job to her boyfriend. Think about that for a second. Just let that sink in for a second. They fire her for engaging in premarital goings on. But, and maybe, you know, maybe the boyfriend didn't really, the boyfriend did it. They offer him the job. You would have to imagine, and I guess you could make the assumption, and I know what they say about assumptions, but you'd have to make some reasonable assumptions that he was involved, and that, you know, he's kind of, you know, equal. So explain to me how it is that he got offered the job and she got fired. You know, just a thought. But, you know, had the college used this at-will employment doctrine, but she said, we just don't want you here. There's no particular reason. It's not because you're a woman. It's not because you may be a minority. And it may not be because you're pregnant. We just don't want you here anymore. That probably would have gone without a lawsuit. Well, the woman has filed a lawsuit, likely under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, that prohibits sex discrimination on the basis of pregnancy. Which, you know, I didn't know there was such a law until I saw this story. And I go, well, good, but we still don't have maternity leave either. Maybe we should be thinking about that law. But it just blows my mind. And I went back and I was thinking about my years growing up. And when I read the story, she was pregnant. I guess the first question I had was, had she had an abortion, would they have known? And then could she have kept her job? Because, I mean, there is another message being sent there as well beyond that. But I remembered back to seventh grade. And in seventh grade, our teacher was Sister Mary St. Leo, who hated me with a passion. And to be honest, the feeling was mutual. Because she was evil and sadistic and repressed and pent up and all of those things that I despise in a nun. It was about just before Christmas, where it looked like Sister was gaining weight. And over Christmas break, she went off to print Bibles at the mission, which I later learned was Catholic for pregnant. So I guess she got fired back then. I always wondered whatever happened to her so that I could go back and share a little bit of my experience with her. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher. Take the program on the go. Questions, comments, something on your mind, something I said got under your skin, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America...